members would mind joining us at the table. Welcome. This is the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement, July 30th, 2014. I don't know if we have any meetings, further meetings planned for this fall. We'll see. This could be my last meeting as chair. We'll see. I'll have to check with Mr. Martin before I announce that officially. And then it'll go to the House next year. They'll be in charge. Today, our plan is to hear presentations by firms selected by the subcommittee, the audit subcommittee. And I wanted to thank Senator Nelson and thank Senator Rosen, who can't be with us. She's in Montana. Senator Goodwin and Senator O'Driscoll, who I think is supposed to be joining us, for carrying out your subcommittee duties. And in a minute, I think we're going to have Mr. Martin give. There's all these whispered conversations going on around me. Maybe I'll just wait. Everyone's done talking.
Attendance.
Okay, I think Senator Murphy's going to join us. So why don't we start out first with Mr. Martin talking about the subcommittee's work.
Okay, members, earlier, either tag end of June or start of July, the Actuarial Services subcommittee met to review the proposals, the written proposals from the seven actuarial firms that submitted proposals in response to our RFP, and narrowed the number down to four finalists. And the four finalists in alphabetical order are printed on your agenda. So that's the recommendation, that these are the four that we would have make presentations to the full pension commission. The contract for actuarial services would run for a period of 5 years. Principally, what the actuary is doing, there are three major tasks that the actuary does on a recurring or regular basis, and then a number of desired or requested tasks. Primarily, the actuary reviews the actuarial work that's done by the actuaries who are retained by the various public pension plans for consistency with good actuarial practice, with the commission's standards for actuarial work, and the provisions of Minnesota Statutes Chapter 356. For one of the pension fund valuations every year, the actuary that would be retained by the pension commission would also be replicated by there would be a replication of one actuarial valuation each year, which is a more thorough review to check the results and to determine whether or not the valuations are fully up to snuff. The commission actuary, the reviewing and auditing actuary retained by the pension commission, also early in the process would review and make recommendations to the commission about changes or modifications that are needed in the commission's standards for actuarial work. This is a set of prescriptions about how the actuarial work is to be provided, is to be prepared. And the commission has been required by statute since 1985 to establish the standards for actuarial work and to periodically upgrade them, revise them. And so that's one of the processes, one of the functions that the commission retained actuary engages in. And then the fourth thing is when there are quadrennial experience studies reported to the pension commission from the three major plans, the three largest plans, MSRS, PERA, and TRA, the commission actuary would also review those experience studies for conformity with the standards and reasonableness. So those are the four main things that the commission actuary does. The commission actuary also is available to provide any consulting advice that you may require. Also to review things like actuarial cost estimates for benefit improvement legislation or some other actuarial matters. So that's primarily what the actuary is doing. And again, the contract runs for a period of five years, which is the maximum period that we can issue a contract before rebidding. In your packets, you do have a number of items. There is a summary of the various proposals that we prepared for the subcommittee. There's also a set of possible questions, if you want to look at those, that raising topics that may require or be advantageous to clarify or pursue. Also have a listing of the references that I've received for the various actuarial firms. With that, members, I'm happy to answer questions, but we can probably have the presentations. We've suggested to the actuarial firms that they keep their presentation in the neighborhood of a half hour.
Half an hour, okay. Does anyone from the subcommittee want to add anything to what Mr. Martin said? Representative Nelson or Senator Goodwin? Okay.
Did the subcommittee did a rating then of them?
Or the subcommittee chose four out of how many?
Oh, okay.
Four out of seven.
They didn't rate those four.
I don't think so. Representative Nelson, did you rank them or rate them or anything?
Madam Chair, no, we didn't rank them. What we did is we looked over them and they judged them, and then the members of the subcommittee basically ranked them one through four and put those in, and then those were tabulated, and these were the four that basically had the most number of ones. We did a sort of a ranked choice voting.
Mm-hmm. How did you decide to choose the top four for us to interview? Were they too close in score to differentiate, or...?
My memory is a little foggy, but it was basically, we looked at the proposals, all the seven proposals, and I think everybody ranked them a little bit differently, but it was looking at, they basically met the criteria, all of them did, and each one had some pluses and minuses, and like I said, it was just the individuals on the subcommittee rank them and how they thought, and again, then we tabulated that, and that's how we got the four.
I think my question was, why four? Why not two? Why not three?
What will be done? I think the last time we did this, we cut it to four and brought forth four names, I think, from that. And I just was hand of note here that number three and four were tied with 1 point.
Okay.
Or 1 point apart when we did it. So that's why we got four instead of three.
Okay. Any other comments? Then why don't we start then? Everyone has their packet of books. Why don't we start with Deloitte? And it's about 12:45, so you have until 1:15. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the Commission, good afternoon. My name is Judy Strombach. I'm the Retirement Actuarial Consulting Practice Leader for the Minneapolis office and also the Chief Pension Actuary for Deloitte Consulting's National Practice. On behalf of our firm, I want to thank you very much for your time today. We very much appreciate the opportunity to meet with you, and we plan to spend the next few minutes explaining why we believe Deloitte is the best choice to serve the Commission for the next few years as your actuarial consultant. I've been with Deloitte for over 30 years, and I spend the majority of my time consulting with both public and private sector employers on pension and post-retirement medical funding, accounting, and plan design issues. I also spend a significant amount of time, as do many of our actuarial staff, working with Deloitte and Touche audit teams in the role of actuarial specialist. And our role on those engagements is to review the actuarial assumptions and methods that are used in financial reporting purposes, and also assist the audit teams in the assessment of the reasonableness of the liabilities. So in my role as the chief pension actuary for Deloitte, I oversee the technical, actuarial, and quality processes for our national pension actuarial practice. I am a fellow of the Society of Actuaries, an enrolled actuary under ERISA, and a member of the American Academy of Actuaries. I also serve on the Actuarial Standards Board Pension Committee, which is the committee that drafts the actuarial standards of practice for appropriate actuarial practice for pension actuaries in the United States. With me today are Michael DeLeon and Eric Rowling, both from our Minneapolis office as well. And I'll have them introduce themselves at this point.
Thank you. Michael DeLeon, been with Deloitte for 17 years here in the Minneapolis office. I lead our public sector actuarial practice nationally and am responsible for the technical issues with government plans and the like in the pension and retiree health arena. I am also a fellow of the Conference of Consulting Actuaries, where I serve on the Public Plans Committee. We address various governmental pension issues throughout the country and provide responses on behalf of the conference. And I am an associate member of the National Association of State Retirement Administrators.
Thank you. I'm Eric Rowling. I've been with Deloitte for 20 years. I am an associate of the Society of Actuaries. I serve a number of public and private clients with their retirement issues, and also am very involved in the audit support process, as Judy had previously explained. I am a fellow of the Conference of Consulting Actuaries and serve as the chair of Deloitte's Retirement Issues Task Force, which evaluates emerging issues in new legislation and analyzes it and disseminates that information to our practice.
Thank you, Michael and Eric. I just wanted to spend a few minutes explaining our proposed structure of the team that would serve you. Because of Michael's significant focus on the public sector, we're proposing that he be your primary contact and lead any projects requested by the Commission. I will be the supervising actuary, so I will review all reports and presentations from a technical perspective. Michael and I will both be available throughout the year for any meetings as requested. As we noted, all three of us are local, all office in Minneapolis, even though we do have national roles with the firm. So we feel accessibility should be a major plus for us. Deloitte's quality review guidance also includes a peer review component, and this is a review with a fresh set of eyes by another experienced actuary that is not involved in the day-to-day performance of the work, and Eric will be serving in that role in our proposal. I'll turn it over to Michael now, and he's going to highlight a few of the more details of our proposal and our value proposition for you.
So if we switch to slide 3 in the presentation, you'll see a little bit more information about what we bring in total to the Commission. First off, we have the right experience to provide these services. We have experience with public pension plans ranging from federal projects, state, local, higher education. We run the gamut on those. But as Judy pointed out, we also have exposure to a large number of plans part of our audit practice. So Deloitte & Touche is responsible for auditing thousands of retirement plans each year and require that an actuarial specialist take a look at these plans as well. The team that we've assigned to work for the Commission has annually is responsible for about 400 of these reviews of plans. And granted, these are limited scope reviews. We just look at assumptions and the valuation reports, but it gives us exposure to a real broad range of different types of plans across the country. So it's both public and private, but it allows us to take that knowledge of a variety of plans and new ideas that are out there and bring those back to the Commission to better serve you. We're also bringing the right team specifically to this project. As Judy mentioned, I'm going to be the lead actuary given my role as a public plans leader for Deloitte, responsible for government pension and retiree health plans. But I'll be backed by a large team, not just the two others you see before you here, but we have a very robust actuarial practice in Minneapolis and nationwide. We have 13 FSAs based in Minneapolis, and we have 83 FSAs, Fellows of the Societies of Actuaries, nationwide. So we have a large practice that we can pull from, experience that we can pull from as necessary. But we're really excited to be able to bring our pension expertise to serve our home state, to work in our backyard. You know, really, you're not getting any less capabilities. These are the same teams we put on a lot of our largest projects, our government projects, and it just so happens we're located in your backyard. So we would be readily available to attend meetings, to respond quickly to needs during session, you know, legislative proposals, et cetera. And if I'm not available to attend the meeting, Judy would be able to step in, or Eric, in the case if two of us happen to be missing. You know, he won't be involved day to day, but he will be knowledgeable about your plans, and you'd have a local resource available to help you. So I think this will be especially important as Ed and Larry are planning to retire in the next couple of years, and you'll have that need for more consultative services from your actuarial firm. So we'll be available to provide those locally. I also want to talk about the value that we're bringing. I think we bring the highest value to you in a couple of ways. First, we have a proven method of reviewing plans that is born out of our responsibilities to our audit practice. So we've come up with a very tight structure around how we review plans. And again, we review thousands of these a year as part of that limited scope process, but we're able to expand that out to a full scope review for the commission. But I want to highlight especially one thing in our proposal, and that's that we plan on making an investment up front in our relationship with the commission. And that would be to perform a matching valuation of all 12 plans in the first year at no additional charge to the commission. So we would do that at our own expense. And we want to do that for a few reasons. One, it'll allow us to give you a more detailed review in the first year. It'll allow us to be more to provide a more smooth transition from your current actuary, so you won't lose that expertise. We'll be able to more quickly get up to speed on all the various issues by putting in all the plan provisions and assumptions in our actuarial evaluation software. It'll also allow us to be more reactive to any requests that come from you. If there's a need for a legislative proposal, we can review those more quickly and in a more detailed way if we have everything programmed within our system. So that's our intention, to make that investment up front. If we flip to the next slide, I wanted to talk briefly about our work at the City of Minneapolis. And that's basically we served the City of Minneapolis for 8 years. Beginning in 2004, we were hired on, in a similar role to what you're asking for here, as sort of a reviewing actuary, to look over the three pension plans that they were responsible for. We helped them understand what the long-term cost responsibilities were to the city, look at risks of investment risks or other risks to the plan that could cause their costs to go up and down, look at legislative proposals as they came up. But we did annual reviews of the work of their actuaries, of their plan's actuaries, and made recommendations based on the assumptions and the results of those valuations. We also provided expert witness testimony during a lawsuit that was brought against the systems and helped them receive a favorable resolution to that lawsuit, which ultimately led to the decision to merge the plan with PARA. And we completed our services about 2 years ago in 2012, just prior to that merger, and have had no further relationships with them. We have no ongoing contracts with the city, no ongoing services, consultative services that we provide. So we don't see this as being any conflict of interest to be able to provide services to the commission. And we see this actually as a benefit in that we spent 8 years, dealing with local issues. We were aware of the issues going on at the state as well as the city. Obviously we were involved pretty detailed ways with PARA prior to the merger, but we stayed abreast of all your issues over the past 10 years, really, while providing those services.
Mr. DeLone, are you providing services to any entity in Minnesota?
No pension plans, no public pension plans. I do lead the retiree health services we provide to the MMB.
Subdivision 8.
So that's the only actuarial services that we provide in
Met Council.
I'm sorry, Met Council. Sorry, we also do the retiree health work for Met Council. Mm. So again, no other pension work.
Um, And as Michael said, we're excited to bring our national expertise to the state of Minnesota. We are committed to our local community, and we wanted to highlight some of our local community investments. Deloitte employs over 800 practitioners in its Minneapolis office. We hired 149 graduates of Minnesota colleges and universities in 2013. So we definitely believe that this exhibits our commitment to the local community. Our professionals serve on more than 50 boards in the Minneapolis community, and we volunteered close to 9,000 hours to support a variety of Minneapolis organizations since January of 2013. And a sampling of the local organizations supported by our firm are shown on page 5. And we believe this does show our commitment to serving Minneapolis and the state of Minnesota. I'll turn it over to Judy to just summarize, and then we'll open it for questions.
Madam Chair, again, we thank you for the time to speak with you today. That is all we had prepared for remarks, so if you would like to open it to questions, we are happy to answer those.
I just wanted to ask Mr. Martin, there were references that were sent, and are there letters, or could you explain what happened with the references?
Madam Chair, I sent out a letter to all of the indicated references for the four, so there were 5 references for each, and I either received phone calls or received letters back. In the case of Deloitte, one phone call and one letter.
And they were positive?
Yes.
Okay. I think I've gotten my question. Let's see. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Representative Murphy.
Thank you.
It's Mr. DeLeon is the lead in the middle.
Mr. Rowling. You said you hired 149 graduates from Minnesota colleges and universities in 2013. Mm-hmm. How many total hires were there?
I would expect that constitutes the majority of it. I don't have a specific number, but it was probably in the range of 200.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. DeLeon, you talked about consultative services. What did you mean by that?
Mr. DeLeon.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, the type of strategic consulting services, if you have questions about our opinion on how a plan is run. So the primary services would be to review the reports and give your opinion on those specific reports. But if there's a legislative proposal that you're considering, or if there's just general information you'd like to know about what other plans are doing around the country, those are the type of consultative services that you might have previously or might currently look to your retirement actuarial staff to provide. And once they retire and they aren't available to provide that that historical knowledge, we'd be able to step in and fill that role.
And Representative Murphy,
that intrigues me, and so I'd like to follow that up a little bit. Because this is the scariest time I've ever been confronted in the years that I've served on the commission, and is the fact that the legislature is not going to have the guidance of our director and assistant director, and we're going to have to go forth with new people. What if the legislature comes up with a proposal that's just in your gut, and from experience, and what's out there, that's really a bad mistake? How would you bring that to us if we didn't ask you about it?
Senator Chair, Representative Murphy, We would be straightforward. I mean, our responsibility in these services is to support you as the commission. And anything we're aware of, we would bring to your attention. If there was something we felt was wholly inappropriate or, as you say, in our gut was just not right, We would lay out the issues as we see them and what the risks are associated with any with the proposal, as well as, you know, the benefits and risks, and allow you to understand what type of results might come of that. So it's our it would be our responsibility to make sure you have the facts to be able to make an intelligent decision, to make an informed decision on any type of proposal that comes up.
But Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Mr. DeLeon, how would you get that? How would you bring it to us?
Mr.
Would
DeLeon.
You call? Would you call on the phone, or would you...
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, we would be available to attend the meetings. I mean, we're, you know, 10 miles away down the street, so we'd be able to come over here and attend the sessions and present them in person. We'd be able to meet with you separately, individually, if you had questions that you'd like to go through. Obviously, we're available via phone, but, you know, I imagine that we would want to have a contact here within the commission that would be the first point of contact if something came up that we were aware of, so we could at least let you know we'd like to come in and talk about this at your next meeting, or maybe we could meet before the next meeting to address this in case a decision's coming out sooner. So I think we would work directly with whoever our point of contact is to make you aware that we have a concern.
But more, Representative Murphy.
I'll let it go.
Okay, Representative Khan.
I wanted to go back to your experience with the city of Minneapolis. One of the problems at the city of Minneapolis, and this changed my opinion on a slightly different legislative issue, had with the pension plan, particularly with MRF, was the authorizing of an early retirement. And the early retirement was one of the things that was just devastating to the pension plan. Now, in the course of the legislature, we've often have people pitching. The pitch for early retirement is that you get rid of all these older, higher-paid people, and then you replace them with people that new employees who aren't being paid quite so much. And that's all true, except particularly in the case of MRF, the savings come to the city, and the cost of it goes to the pension plan. And I think we've started looking at that a little bit now as these things come back. Did you raise that issue at any time when you were looking at things, that the early retirements was going to, which seems so, the city was the only people who made the decision on that, and that was going to wreak havoc on the pension plan?
Did that happen while Deloitte was the auditor, or was that previous to that?
I mean, either way.
I don't know.
Did they look at
it? Yeah, okay. Mr. DeLeon, were you involved?
Madam Chair, Representative Khan, we were not involved at that time when those decisions were being made. You know, it takes a holistic view whenever an early retirement window is being considered of who benefits and who pays the bill ultimately. There were a number of situations that did come up where decisions were being made by a board that was specific to the plan, which had City of Minneapolis members on it, but the decisions were being made by the plan. Majority members were related to the plan, that again, they didn't have responsibility to make the contributions. So in our role, it was more often that where the plan would make a proposal and we would tell the city, this is what is going to impact you in the long term in your contributions. This is the sort of the things you may not see up front with, you know, in year one, you save, you know, $10 million, but years 2 through 10, it's going to cost you $20 million. So just understand what you're getting out of this impact.
Well, Madam Chairman, what I'm trying to point out is the difference between the cost to the city and the cost to the plan, and the fact that I don't think, until recently, these things have been brought out when people have been talking about early retirements. And I think it was a surprise to many of us to see what the cost to the plan was and how the plan could not sustain it. But then, even if you came in afterwards, did you point that out ever as a problem, that that had been part of the thing that caused the problem?
It does kind of fall into a broader question of what is the firm's approach to raising problems that you see, or errors or inconsistencies or omissions?
Madam Chair, Representative Khan, when we were addressing various types of issues, the early retirement window itself, and it had already occurred, so I don't think that we made, we had a specific discussion about that. But our responsibility was to serve the interests of the city. So our focus was on things that impacted their bottom line. And if there was something that transferred cost to the state, we definitely made them aware of that. But it wasn't to make them aware. You know, again, their focus was on the bottom line, so understanding this is what happened. So example of the merger with PARA, it was to understand, okay, this is what will impact your costs, and this is what risks the state will take on instead of you taking them on. So from your bottom line, it's more advantageous, you know, ultimately, to as the city, and that's who we were advocating for, was the city in that role.
Hmm. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, I heard, you know, a little bit from each of you about your education and some of your experience, but what I really like to know is, outside of maybe the city of Minneapolis, what other public pension plans have each of you worked on through the years?
I'll give you a
Strombeck.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Goodwin. This is not a current example, but I thought it was, as I was thinking about preparing for this presentation, it reminded me that when I started at the time Touche Ross 30 plus years ago, one of my first assignments was to work on the Minnesota State Retirement System valuation. So I was the actuarial analyst that, you know, worked on the data for the judge's plan back, you know, 30 years ago. So, more recently, I oversee the work for the South Dakota Department of Labor, Alabama State Docs, City of Grand Forks. All of those engagements, Michael and Eric are also involved in as well.
Good day, Madam Chair.
Oh, sound good one.
Go ahead. I think you were going to give me a response. I would like a response from each of you. Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Mr. DeLong.
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin. I work on, as Judy mentioned, South Dakota and Alabama are two of the ones that I currently serve. I also provide consultative services to the state of Illinois. It's led by an actuary in Illinois, but I consult on that as well. I provide other services to some of our related services to groups in Tennessee and in Detroit. I get my entire list here. In California. So as a national practice leader, I have responsibility to sort of have some oversight in relationship to all of our public clients, but those are the ones that I'd say that I'm most involved with or have been most involved with.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Rawlings.
Thank you. I serve as the lead actuary for the City of Grand Forks Pension Plan, doing the annual valuation for that, which I have served for roughly 10 years. And I also served a key role in services that we provided to the Federal Department of Energy, reviewing all of their contractor pension plans and helping them manage the risk and funding for those federal plans.
Sorry, good one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have any of you we've been responsible for plans as big as the state of Minnesota with all of the separate plans that we have? I guess that's my question.
Mr. DeLeon.
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin, the Department of Energy is one that is similarly complex and large as the state of Minnesota and has a variety of systems. It's a little different structure, but it's similar in size. And there's also the naval installation that we have touched on briefly that has a similar size as your plans. Also, I also do a lot of retiree health work, which is some of the same issues as the pension plans face, and there are a number of them that have that are similarly large to the state of Minnesota that I work on.
Final question. Good one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My final question is, what do you do to help your clients evaluate, or do you have some kind of periodic evaluations, and who do they go to so that the pension commission understands and the retirement plans what kind of job we think you're doing?
Ms. Strombeck.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Goodwin, Deloitte does have a client satisfaction protocol for our larger clients, in which we annually will send someone. Generally, it will not be one of us. It will be someone else from Deloitte to just take the pulse of how we're doing, you know, ask you questions. Are we serving you well? You know, are there things we could do to improve? And you will hear from us what the results of that were, especially if there are any you know, items for improvement. We try to incorporate that feedback into our work in future years.
Madam Chair,
I'm going to ask you or staff, is this a five-year contract we're letting?
It's a five-year contract.
Okay, so then my final question, after my final question, is is do you then do this annually or every 2 years, or how do you do this?
Yes, our protocol is annually.
Okay, thank you.
Strombeck, sorry. I had a question, which is, according to my notes, that you highlight four audit or review consultations from Illinois, Minneapolis, U.S. Department of Energy, and U.S. Coast Guard that have or were perceived to have significant pension funding issues. So what is the firm's role in addressing pension funding problems, like these four government entities, for example?
Sure.
Mr. Rawlings.
And Chairman. I assisted the finance director for the Department of Energy's. They contract with a number of contractor that run their installations for the Department of Energy. The key challenge that they had, which is mirrored in some of the state's concerns as well, is that the pensions were run by the individual contractors but were funded by the federal government. And so the federal government was responsible for the funding, but at that time did not have much input into the riskiness of the assets, the level at which you funded, and so one of our largest recommendations, which was implemented, was to de-risk a number of the plans and to have the Department of Energy take a greater level of oversight and input into the riskiness of the assets and the investment strategy.
And can you just give me an example maybe from Illinois?
Well, from Illinois, there's been some unique challenges there. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
That's an ongoing
contract. It's an ongoing contract. We still serve the state of Illinois in that. Mm-hmm. And as I said, there's a different lead actuary that's on that, but I do consult on that. And we've provided one of our initial projects was to come in and help them look for sort of low-hanging fruit areas of problems that they could easily correct. For example, there was pension spiking going on in Illinois, where you know individual schools might provide a much higher pay in the final year, agree to you know a big pay increase, maybe a 50% pay increase in their final year to allow them to get a much bigger, better pension benefit, which again ultimately is paid by the state or spread out across the systems. So an individual school district can get away with a better pension benefit for their retirees at less cost. And we helped recognize this issue and came up with a solution to address it and ultimately helped pass legislation where they each individual school district was responsible. I don't recall what the cutoff was, but if the pay increase in the final 3 years was over X percent, then the school district was required to pay the actual equivalent costs of the increased pension benefit. So pretty quickly that practice stopped after that was implemented. And there was no benefit reductions, so there was nothing. No, there was no legal ramifications of reducing benefits for employees or retirees. Mm-hmm. It was merely a funding vehicle of who's responsible for the cost if you're going to do this. That solved that problem.
Okay. Thank you. Any final questions before we move on? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And whoever wants to get this, in your proposal, you indicated that there would be some range of liability limits going forward. What are we going to be looking at that? As far as what would those liability limits be? And I guess that's the question I have.
Ms. Strombeck.
Thank you. Representative Nelson and Madam Chair, limitation of liability is something that is required in most Deloitte contracts. We do negotiate that depending on the nature of the work.
So we would have to, you know, see what the final language would be once if you do decide to move forward with us. But we are confident that we will be able to come to some mutual resolution on that issue, given the number of other contracts that Deloitte does have with the state of Minnesota. So we would use those current contracts as a guide for what would likely be acceptable in this situation as well.
Has there been any, have you been found liable for anything through litigation or arbitration in the last 5 years? Have you had any issues?
Well, it depends on who you say. Deloitte is a very large firm. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure across all of Deloitte, yes, we probably have. I don't even know, though, you know, what the details of those would be. Certainly nothing in the pension actuarial practice for the last 5 years. We have had any issues from a litigation perspective.
Okay, thank you very much. You're welcome to stay in the room or wait across the hall. We have a room available across the hall.
Thank you very much for your time again.
Bring them back for questions. I don't know. We'll see. Okay, next alphabetically in order is Foster and Foster.
Oh, let me go get them.
Oh, okay.
Members, just you were talking about Minneapolis and an early retirement incentive, and I'm not sure that's a correct characterization exactly of what the circumstance was. Minneapolis, MRF before 1970 had a 30 and out or an age 60 retirement for its non-uniform, its general employee plan, and had age 50 retirement ages for its police and fire. There may have been incentives in terms of cash bonuses or something that was not in the pension plan, but MRF and Minneapolis Police and Fire always had relatively low ages for retirement, which disruptions or something in the workforce or other things could incentivize someone to leave early. But I don't know that there was exactly a pension plan provision that ever was changed.
No, I know
as an incentive.
I know a pension plan provision was never planned, but I was saying that the city could utilize the benefits of early retirement because all the costs, the costs of early retirement then went to the pension plan.
Yes.
They may have had it in place earlier. That's the issue. Yeah.
Thanks. Okay, Foster and Foster, welcome. We have about a half hour to spend with you.
Okay, great. Does that include Q&A or is that
it includes just Q&A?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, well, I'll get started then. Good afternoon, everybody. I am Jason Franken, and this is my colleague Brad Heinrichs. We are with Foster & Foster. First of all, we'd like to thank you for the opportunity to make this presentation to you today. I'll give you a little bit about a little background on me, and then I'll hand it over to Brad. I'm Jason Franken. I'm a fellow of the Society of Actuaries and an enrolled actuary. I have 17 years of actuarial consulting experience. I've been with Foster & Foster for about 6.5 years now. I'm located in our Oak Brook Terrace office in Illinois, a western suburb. That would be the primary office of contact for the commission. If we were fortunate enough to be awarded this work, I would be the lead consultant, and I have a team of actuaries and consultants that would be dedicated to the team back in the office. Now I'll turn it over to Brad. He'll give you a little background and then get started with our presentation.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Heinrichs.
My name is Brad Heinrichs. I'm the president and CEO of Foster & Foster. I've been such since 2005. I'm also a fellow of the Society of Actuaries and enrolled actuary. I like to tell people that's kind of like that don't know anything about actuarial work. It's kind of like being an Eagle Scout. We know how to tie all the appropriate knots and do all of the complex calculations. I've also been a consulting actuary for about 17 or so years. My primary role with the firm is in addition to the general president, CEO sorts of duties, are to be a lead consultant on some larger cases. But primarily, I'm a key consultant to lawmakers when they're looking at proposed legislation, whether it be in Louisiana or Florida, my home state. I'm actually located in Fort Myers, Florida, in the southwest part of Florida by Naples. If you have your books, does everybody have a book that? What I'd like to do is to just.
You're talking about the.
The small one. Yes, okay. Yes, the small one. Yes.
Okay.
What I thought I would do is just tell you a little bit about our firm, and who our clients are, and then I'll turn it over to Jason to kind of fill in some of the gaps. Our firm was founded in 1979 by Ward and Eileen Foster, hence your Foster and Foster. As I mentioned, our headquarters is in Fort Myers, Florida. The mission of our firm in 1979 was to provide actuarial consulting services to public pension plans in Florida. We had several cases at that time. I took over in 2005, and after getting about half the market share in Florida, decided that we should provide the same sort of consulting services elsewhere. We opened up a Chicago office. Jason runs that office. And now we provide actuarial consulting services in 7 or 8 states or so. We derive 100% of our revenue from actuarial consulting services. Most of the time it's on the public pension side. We really don't even have any private cases. It's all public pension plans. We also do some OPEB or other post-employment benefit plans and health and welfare services as well. So you move to page 3, talking a little bit about our people. We have 13 credentialed actuaries with over 220 years of public consulting experience on the actuarial side. That includes 5 fellows of the Society of Actuaries, Jason and I being 2 of those. We have 21 additional staff members that support us. I should mention that one of our missions or goals is to be the best actuarial firm in which to work. Since 2005, we've never had an actuary leave on his or her own accord. We've either we're a great place to work, or nobody's found any place they'd rather be, at least at this point. So we're pretty proud of the fact that when you hire Foster and Foster and you get your consultants, those are the ones that you're going to be working with through the duration. Our clients on page 4, as I mentioned before, we have quite a few public retirement programs, over 250 public retirement programs that we're the lead actuary for. In actuality, we actually perform actuarial evaluations for nearly 900 public plans. I don't know if anybody actually keeps track or of how many each firm does, but we've got to be near the top in terms of public plan actuarial evaluations. I mentioned here on top of page 4 where our clients are. Our clients are of different sizes. We've got some very small clients, and we've got clients with over 200,000 members. Range from an asset perspective, we've got some with just a few million dollars in assets to as many as $15 billion in assets. I'll talk a little bit about some of the clients that I work with, and then I'll turn it over to Jason. The Florida Division of Retirement hires us to do almost exactly what you are asking us to do, or putting the RFP out for, and that is to review other actuarial valuation reports. We replicate other actuaries' valuations. We actually provide actuarial evaluations for clients or for small plans that the Florida Division of Retirement is in charge of. So it's a very, very similar kind of task that we perform in Florida to what you're looking for here. In addition, when bills are proposed or put forth, I'm one of the key cogs, I guess, in evaluating how these plan or how these bills might impact the Florida plans, the Florida public plans. And so I do a lot of work with lawmakers to help them understand what the bills mean and then put a price tag to their impact. In Louisiana, the two larger funds there, the Louisiana State Employees and the Teachers Retirement System of Louisiana, I'm more of a political and actuarial strategist when it comes to proposed legislation. I also work on alongside the lead actuary, who's located in Baton Rouge, to deliver the actuarial consulting services there. Jason, I'll turn it over to you to talk a little bit about some of your relevant clients, then we'll move forward.
Thanks. A couple others that I want to touch on. First of all, the City of Dallas. They hired us last year to perform an actuarial audit, so it was a full replication audit, very similar to what we would be doing annually as part of this project. They have three funds. Two of them are $3 billion each in terms of the amount of assets. They have another smaller supplemental plan, but we just actually sent the report to them last week. So we will be meeting with the City of Dallas and their pension boards here over the next few weeks, just to go over the report and discuss any potential changes that need to be made from an actuarial perspective or even from a benefit calculation perspective. So this client is very similar in nature to the type of work we would be doing here. Additionally, the Illinois Department of Insurance, that's another pretty big client that we have. For them, we provide actuarial services. And part of their function within the state of Illinois is to provide actuarial evaluations to all of their police and fire pension funds. So as a result, we do over 650 valuations per year for all the police and fire funds in the state of Illinois, on behalf of the Department of Insurance. So it's obviously a lot of work, but it's something that we help them build an actuarial system rather than using a third-party system. So we designed and tested that. So it's been a very fun and entertaining actuarial project, if you can believe that. Another aspect of that is we are very involved anytime there's proposed legislation. We do run the numbers for them to determine what impact financially any changes that are being proposed would have on the system. And just this spring, I guess it was, there was negotiations going on between, I guess it was a Senate committee, but there were labor, there was city municipal leaders negotiating potential changes. I was involved in that, outlining the impact that the potential changes would have on the pension funds. So once again, it's a state agency we've been very involved with, and like I said, I think that experience would be very valuable, in this particular case as well. The last one, the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District, we provide actuarial services to them. I am the lead consultant on that account as well.
State is that in?
That's in Illinois. It's in Chicago. It's a Cook County fund. It's an extremely large fund, very similar to in size to many of the funds that we would be working with in this case. Moving on to page five, we've covered a lot of our experience, but I'll just run through it again briefly. Providing ongoing actuarial services to over 250 clients. We have a good sense of we're experts at providing these services. We know what needs to be done, the most efficient ways to do it, and so we're experts in providing the actuarial services. Additionally, we've talked about our experience dealing with legislators in three different states, helping educate them on pension plans, because I realize that pension plans aren't everybody's day job like it is for us. So we try to help explain the intricacies of changing benefits and how that will impact the cities, the plan sponsors, and how the benefit changes will impact the members as well.
We also, if I can interject, Jason, we also have a public plan sector database with all sorts of information that our clients can tap into. If they're trying to figure out, how does our plan compare to others? We've got benchmarking information that we can provide to help them understand, really, are we providing a rich plan, an average plan, or is the plan that we're providing really not up to par relative to peers, either in our state or across the country.
The last item on this page, just, you know, we have performed full-blown replication audits. You know, I mentioned the Dallas one. We've done that for many other plans across the country. Brad had mentioned we do this in Florida. We do this in Illinois. So we're very familiar with the process of the replication. Moving on to page six, our approach, you know, the keys, in our opinion, to providing quality service. First and foremost is accuracy. The numbers have to be right, otherwise our clients lose faith in us. And in order to ensure our accuracy, we use the most sophisticated actuarial software that's out there. It's not something that's developed and maintained in-house. We've discovered that, you know, having a firm this is all they do is develop the actuarial software is a much better model. So we're not constantly assigning resources to perform updates to our system. And additionally, we've implemented a peer review process that is second to none. We have an actuary who has 35 years of experience, over 35 years of experience. He ran the New York office of one of the largest actuarial firms in the country. You know, that's his entire job. He retired from his private sector job, moved to Florida, discovered us, and he decided he wasn't done, ready to quit working yet. So he came on and developed our peer review process. And, you know, essentially his team members see every single deliverable that leaves our door. And I feel that that's important. To ensure that our accuracy is high and we're eliminating mistakes. The second key is a responsiveness and timeliness. We like to treat every client as if they're our only client. So if you're calling me, I'm going to get back to you as soon as possible. I think if you talk to, you know, some of our clients, you would, you know, one of the things that they would say is, you know, hey, they're always available to us. They're always willing and able to answer our questions. The third key is cost. Obviously, cost is an important issue. The less you pay, the better for you, and the better for the state. So we like to keep the cost as low as possible. We do have a lower overhead than most firms. Like I said, a lot of that has to do with the actuarial software. For example, we just outsource that rather than keeping that maintained internally, because that adds up quite quickly when you're trying to maintain internal software. Communication ability, we pride ourselves in being able to deliver complicated messages to people of various levels of experience when it comes to pensions. Both Brad and I and other people in our firm, we speak at actuarial conferences across the country, public pension conferences, and we speak to, you know, trustees, we speak to other actuaries, and depending on who's in the room, the level of our message has to be changed, and we feel that we're pretty good at helping people at all levels understand these complicated issues. And the last thing is value added. What can we do on top of the typical actuarial services that our clients like? And, you know, we've developed tools such like as online benefit calculations, online benefit calculator. We have an online projection tool. These type of things have been very helpful for our clients. On page seven, our passion. We have a passion for education. As I mentioned, we speak at conferences across the country. In most cases, we're not doing it. We're not being paid to do it. We're doing it to help trustees make educated decisions. And so we donate our time to help people understand these issues, so when they're, you know, when they're sitting in the boardroom at the table making important decisions for the future of their pension fund, they understand all the ramifications.
Mr. Franken, yes. I want to make sure we have time for questions.
Okay.
So I think that was very great presentation, and let's take some questions now because we have about 10 more minutes.
Okay. Yes.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and either of you, have you read the principles of this pension commission? Are you aware of the principles?
Yes. Yep.
And if
Mr.
you're
Franken.
If you differed on those principles, what would happen?
Well, first of all, we would have to understand, you know, we would want to understand how those principles were developed, what, you know, what your all your objectives are, and if we feel that there would be a different approach that would be that would better serve the commission, you know, we would want to discuss that with you. We would bring any suggestions for changes that we would that we see, we would bring those to you and have a, you know, an educated discussion on why things are being done the way they are and why we feel that, you know, some minor tweaks, you know, may better serve the commission.
Thank you.
Have you learned any lessons from previous audits that you think would be useful in auditing the Minnesota pension system? You know, like anything you've worked with where pensions, there have been pension problems, for example.
Can you handle it? You want to?
Go ahead. If you.
Okay. Well, so maybe we should both answer that one. My answer would be that the first thing I've learned is that these audits are actually a really good idea, because not only is it refreshing and important for you all to understand that the numbers are created in an actuarially appropriate manner, but our experiences may differ from the actuaries for these individual plans, and we may be able to provide them some ideas and processes that might help things work smoother, might help the client themselves understand, give them different choices that maybe they hadn't had been brought to them before. So, you know, there have been times when we've done audits that, you know, frankly, it was clear to us that maybe the actuary could be using maybe a different cost method or a different approach to developing the funding requirements, brought it to them, and the actuary had the discussion with the client. They made the change. Everybody was happy.
Jason. Yeah, and so,
Mr. Franken.
Yes, in my experience of performing audits, I've discovered that transparency is always a key. And while the current actuary or the retained actuary by the fund may be doing everything according, you know, in line with the actuarial standards of practice, and everything is done, you know, appropriately, there may be issues that aren't necessarily clear to someone who's picking up the actuarial evaluation. The board may understand it, but, you know, as an example, I've seen instances where there was a change to the asset method, the smoothing method, where after 2008 there were some huge losses, and the asset method was changed to extend the recognition period of those losses. And so what happens is the new asset method is being done according to the actual standards of practice, but it was done at a period of time in which it has a dramatic impact on the results. And rather than being 80% funded under the old method, under the new method, the plan is, you know, 88% funded. And so while everything is being done appropriately, you know, I feel like transparency in the actuarial evaluations is, you know, very important to having the user who's looking at the report understand everything, including, you know, where the plan is, you know, from a financial perspective.
Yeah, sometimes when plans get suddenly healthy, it's not because they made a lot of money. It's because there were some actuarial changes that artificially propped up the funding level.
Some actuarial magic, if you will.
Right. I'm sorry. Questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Henrich, I think you had made the comment in your setup and presentation that since 2005, there were no actuaries within your firm or organization that left on their own accord.
Yes.
That raises the question to me that there might have been some who have left that weren't on their own accord. Could you, without violating any personnel-related matters, expound on that for us, please?
Sure. Good question. there's really, I'm making sure that I'm saying this correctly. I believe there's only been two actuaries that have been terminated from our firm. I can tell you that we have a very high standard. We want to be the best actuarial firm in the country. And if I don't believe that you're meeting our standard for excellence, then we make sure that person is no longer part of the team. The cliche about you're only as strong as your weakest link, I think, is somewhat true. And so we want to make sure that every member of our team is strong and capable. We don't have a firm of 100 actuaries. We have a firm of 13 credentialed actuaries. And so we want to make sure that every one of those credentialed actuaries who is going to be the face of the firm to their client, we want to make sure that they all meet a really high standard. And so that's about all I can really say without getting into the personal. There's never been any the reasons were all internal. There was never any issues with clients. I can tell you that I can't think the last time that we've been fired for cause from a client since 2005. Our client retention is really unparalleled. Can you think of a client that's? I don't know. I don't know of any of offhand that have said, you know, we don't think you're doing a good job, we're going to replace you.
Rep. Sal Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Henrick, I do want to pursue this just a little bit, and sure. I am respectful of the data privacy issues, and sure. I will stay away from some of those. Would it be safer to characterize that there were work product issues and production issues more so than compliance with standards and practices?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is correct.
Thank you.
Questions? Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, and bear with me a little minute. I have a couple here. I want to ask again, like I did to the last firm. I see that you have experience with Louisiana State Employees Retirement System. What is the number of plans that they have within that system that you are?
The Louisiana State Employees Retirement System is one fund that has around $15 billion or $16 or $17. I mean, it's somewhere in there. In assets, there are a bunch of different entities within the state employees retirement system, same as the teachers retirement system of Louisiana, which has a lot of different school districts in Louisiana. Both of those have more than $10 billion in assets, several hundred thousand members. My job is to be sort of a co-lead or maybe even a second chair on that client. We have a credentialed actuary that we hired who's in Baton Rouge that is servicing that account on the ground. So a local actuary there.
Madam Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Next question. And the same is, I want to ask the same question for the Illinois Department of Insurance. How many plans do they have that you oversee?
In that case, it's over 650. I think the number is about 660. There's been some new plans added in the last couple of years. So I believe the number is right around 660.
And Madam Chair, do you oversee all of those?
Yes. Yeah. So we provide actuarial valuations to all of the funds. We work, like I said, with the Department of Insurance on that. So the reports are coming, being issued by the Department of Insurance because that's part of their requirement, their duties. But I sign every one of the valuations that is delivered to those 660 plans.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. I see from this that you don't have anybody that would be stationed right here in Minnesota. So, what do you do about travel? Then are we responsible for travel expenses?
No, there was
charges.
I believe in the RFP response. I believe we said that there would be two in-person meetings that are part of our fee, two annually.
Okay. Madam Chair, Mr. Frank, and then what public pension plans have you personally been retained by in the recent past?
Well, in the recent past, within the last 3 years, the Department of Insurance was a new client. That was 2000 and 2012. I was hired by the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District in 2013. And then within the last year, there are several police and fire plans within the state of Illinois that have hired us to do actuarial or provide actuarial services to the boards. So there's like Peoria Police, Hoffman Estates Fire, you know, relatively, you know, smaller plans within the state of Illinois that have hired us. Additionally, the city of Dallas hired us last year to provide actuarial services in terms of the audit. I'm the lead actuary on that account as well.
I should mention, too, that...
Mr. Hendricks.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's
okay. Okay, sorry.
I just say your name for the tape.
Oh, okay. So yes, sorry. I should also mention, just to be clear, that of these 600-plus valuations that Jason's signing for in Illinois, they all basically have the same plan provisions. So it's not as if there are 660 unique pension programs. There's unique members in these plans, but the provisions themselves and the assumptions that are being utilized are all somewhat uniform. So it's not a it's not as if you have 660 complex unique cases.
I don't know if actuary firms do this, but do you ever have your work audited by another actuary firm?
Oh yes.
That's exactly what we're doing in the city of Dallas as part of the Texas Pension Code. They require these audits every 5 years.
Okay.
And so we have a number of clients in Texas, so we've sort of been on both sides of it.
Yeah.
We've been the firm that has been audited by other actuarial firms, and we are, you know, auditing other actuarial firms, their valuations that they perform on behalf of the board or the cities.
Have you had any issues with your audits?
Never.
Nope.
Never.
One more final question, Madam Chair. I know the state of Illinois' pension plans are in trouble, and I'm thinking Louisiana's are as well. I'm not sure about that. But how long have you been? How long have you been providing services to them, and what are the problems that you've been able to identify and solve?
Yes,
in 2 minutes or less.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to have to cut the list
in 2 minutes.
Yeah, I'm going to have to cut the list down in about a third. Then I've been working on a public pension plans in the state of Illinois for 6.5 years now. The biggest issue is that the money, the contributions just have not been made to the plans.
Employer and employee contributions?
Well, employee contributions are required. Mm-hmm. So those contributions go into the plan. So it's the plan sponsor contributions. And the reason for that is there is no enforcement mechanism. So I'm the actuary. I develop the actuarial required contribution. It comes out to be $1 million. And a city looks at that and says, you know, we're building a new school this year. I don't have $1 million. Here's $300,000. There's no ramifications for that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happened for decades now, is that the money just is not set aside. There's one plan in the state of Illinois. It's the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund, IMRF, that has an enforcement mechanism. So the cities and municipalities are required to make contributions to that plan, the actuarial contribution.
By state law.
By state law. And not surprisingly, that plan is nearly 100% funded.
Mm-hmm.
You don't hear about that one because all the other ones are in bad shape. Some of the plans are 25, 26% funded, but they haven't had contributions made to them in an actuarial way over decades now.
Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, you have to be a bit delicate. Would it be fair to say that a lot of the problems are generally caused by politicians unsuccessfully attempting to suspend the laws of mathematics? Would that normally be?
You don't have to comment on that.
Yes. And one other thing. In the Illinois Pension Code, a lot of the methods for funding are dictated in the Illinois Pension Code. So they're written by lawmakers who aren't necessarily actuaries.
Mm-hmm.
And so those methods are designed for political reasons, I would say, and not necessarily on sound actuarial principles. And so even if you're making the actuarial contribution according to what's in the Illinois Pension Code, that may, or in many cases, may not be the appropriate contribution to really that leads to a healthy and sustainable pension plan.
Okay, this has sparked more interest, Senator Johnson, and then try to make your answer short.
If Detroit went bankrupt, what would happen if a city goes bankrupt or needed to put money into pensions for people?
What would happen to the pension fund if the city went bankrupt?
What would you recommend?
What would we recommend?
Don't do that.
That's a good. It's actually a question that's being debated at now. It's not, I don't know that there is a real answer.
You're now speaking at a conference about that.
Yeah, right. And we get these kinds of questions. The city typically doesn't just vanish off the map. And I know that the courts will probably be the final verdict and word as far as, okay, I'm a retiree, the city's gone bankrupt, we don't have enough assets to pay me.
Who's responsible?
Who's going to be responsible? The courts are probably going to have to decide that. In certain states with different laws,
bankruptcies.
What happens to the pension fund?
Nobody's ever done it.
Okay. Yeah, it's really like I said, these are new questions. We're kind of in a new frontier as far as that goes. But what you will see, I will say this, I'll make a prediction for you. With the onset of the new Governmental Accounting Standards Board, Rules 67 and 68 specifically, okay, the new accounting standards, whereas before cities only had to record the shortfall in contributions as a liability on their books, now they're going in 2015 they're going to have to record the entire unfunded liability on their books. And what you will see is that there will be many cities across the country who will suddenly have a balance sheet that's upside down, and then these questions are really going to be asked.
Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate your excellent presentation. Let's move on to Milliman.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Were we supposed to sign?
Yes. It's supposed to, for the record, so if you would.
Staple Investment has about $60 billion in assets, give or take.
I mean, their biggest is $15 billion. They really want us.
But understand that the Minnesota State Board of Investment is 11 plans.
I understand that. But
yeah, but they're telling you plan by plan by plan, and this is an aggregation of several plans, so they could probably aggregate a few that would get in that neighborhood. She wants to do something.
That Hogan guy. The guy that Whitney snapshot in time when they reported to the commission.
Welcome.
In this room.
Good morning.
We have about half an hour, which includes questions.
Very good. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Legislative Commission, Bill Hogan and Tim Herman from Milliman. It's a pleasure to be here today. It's a beautiful day outside.
Don't tell us that.
Yes. We're here to put out some of the key points that we feel our proposal brings for our services, and you should have a handout in front of you, which is in a slide format, which covers the points we plan to address today. So with that, we've kind of got a couple of slides up front, just kind of giving an over or talking about what we're going to get to. So let's just skip straight to slide 3. With Milliman, we feel very strongly that you're going to get the expertise of individuals who've worked on large state public plans, which we think makes a difference. Working on smaller plans is good too. There's a lot of experience there, and we have that. But there's a difference between volume servicing and actually providing analytical services, and we think we're very strong in that capacity. Our project team brings significant expertise to the assignment. We have 5 FSAs in our proposal that all have worked on your plans and will continue to do so should you rehire us. We bring significant institutional knowledge and our experience to the assignment, which is, we feel, a pretty important point, to the extent that we already understand the issues and what's going on, and we have things set up so that we don't have to recreate the wheel. And I think that gives us the ability to be, going forward, a great consultant for your purposes, because we do have that history with us. When we do your work, we have an independent valuation system, which we feel gives us a true audit review. It does allow us to be independent of the audit results of the system that's being used to prepare the results, and we think that is a significant point. We feel like our fee proposal is fair and reasonable, and it shows an ability to provide the analysis that you are expecting and need. If you compare our billing rates to the project fees that have been proposed, it allows for significant enough time so that the people in the proposal can actually spend enough hours on the work. So those two should match up, and if they don't, you know, then you kind of have to wonder. So we feel like our proposal is pretty good there. And quite honestly, we're very excited to continue in this assignment. We love doing this analysis. It allows us to do critical thinking and to really look at what's going on, and with the history, it's interesting to us to see how things progress, and it's great to come to Minneapolis. So that's kind of an overview of our
in St. Paul
and St. Paul.
Thank you,
Minneapolis, St. Paul. I apologize for
where's
that.
Where's your corporate headquarters?
Corporate headquarters for us is in Seattle. When we say corporate headquarters, that's really where administrative functions are prepared on a corporate basis. Decision making and work that we do within the Milwaukee office is decided upon by the Milwaukee team, which is headed by me. So I pretty much have the authority on how the Milwaukee office operates.
Okay.
So moving to slide 4. Our expertise, we believe, is very strong. We were founded in 1947, so we got significant experience as an actuarial firm. We've been around quite a while. Our first client by Wendell Milliman was the state of Washington, so we do have a large statewide government experience going all the way back to when we started. We are independently owned by the principals of the firm, so there are no ulterior things going on that might cause us to have other agendas or other things in play. We have instituted significant peer review
policies and practices to meet the demands of providing a high-quality work product. And our work here, for instance, will get reviewed both by Tim and I. We review each other's work, and then Alan Bittner will review it, and then sometimes we, depending on the assignment, it'll get reviewed by other individuals in our other offices. We have a strategic planning group within Milliman, of which we belong to, strictly for public plan issues, actuarial and other issues in consulting with our clients. We have individuals in Philadelphia. Glenn Bowen has done significant consulting on some very significant public plan issues. Matt Larrabee in Portland. Mark Ullman heads that group in Seattle, and a number of other people who are involved in that work. So Milliman is committed to this work. We have a lot of experience, and we are committed to serving the commission in that capacity. If you move to slide 5 real quickly, I think you can see that our growth is substantial within Milliman. We are diversified, so we do a lot of different things, but certainly we have significant work in the retirement plan industry. On slide 6, this would be a duplication of what you would have seen in our proposal. These are the individuals in our team. I think it demonstrates significant stability on the team that's providing your work. These individuals have worked in our office for many years, and we don't have any people coming in and then leaving real quick and leaving our clients who are expecting to have somebody work on their plan not be there when they hire them. You can see that we've got the group combined for more than 50 years of providing service to the Legislative Commission. With that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague Tim to get into some more of the other items here on our points.
Mr. Herman.
Madam Chairman, Commission members, page 7 lists the institutional knowledge that Milliman has of the Minnesota pension plans. From 92 to 2002, we served as the retained actuary for the commission. In that capacity, we performed the official valuation results, did the experience studies, and did the legislative cost estimates. Listed in the column on the left are some of the examples of some of the special projects we did in that capacity. Since 2009, we have been serving as commission actuary. In this role, we have done the actual audit work, we've reviewed experience studies, and done a few other special projects. Some of those are also listed there. Throughout both of those periods of service to the commission, Bill has served in one of the consultant roles. Going back to the retained actuary for the commission, I started off as a student at Milliman, so I was the one actually doing the work, eventually worked my way up to the valuation manager, and now I'm fulfilling one of the consultant roles. Definitely very happy to be here and excited to continue working for the commission. We feel one of the values that we bring is kind of illustrated on page 8. We have our own proprietary valuation system. It provides another layer of independence to the review that we're doing. We're not just checking that the parameters to the valuation system are entered correctly by the fund actuary, but we're independently coding our proprietary valuation system, and that provides an extra layer of independent review of the results that the fund actuary is doing. Not only do we have the team that Bill talked about as far as who's delivering the services, in our corporate offices, we also have a systems and programming team that they're the ones that are charged with developing and maintaining the system. And two of the individuals there are also fellows in the Society of Actuaries. So this provides a very deep resource for you in fulfilling the review capacity for the reviewing actuary. One of the things that, to me, is fascinating working on the Minnesota plans is the level of complexity that is involved in the valuation process. Not only is your benefit structure very complex, the last few years you have instituted a select and ultimate interest rate assumption. Mm-hmm. That adds another layer of complexity. And just this past year, you've adopted a new approach to measuring the COLA assumption, where lower COLA is assumed until the full funding date and then the higher COLA after that. That's another layer of complexity in the valuation system that having an independent valuation system that's explicitly modeling that future is another layer of added protection and comfort for you that we really are independently checking the fund actuary's results. Page 9 is a repeat of the goals that has been stated for the Legislative Commission. Here, I think the two important things are moving forward, looking for sound pension funding policy. Part of the way that we would support you in that is by doing the technical review and analyzing proposed legislation when that comes up. But it's also bringing to your attention other information that might not be apparent just from the technical review, but issues that make a difference when looked at over the long term so that you know where you're going over the long term. Page 10 is sort of the review of how we would do that. One part of it is the replication review. In the replication review, we are independently verifying the fund actuary's results. We're starting by getting the data from the fund administrator, independently coding our valuation system, producing our own valuation results, and comparing that to the fund actuary. Since 2009, we have done a replication valuation for 10 of the different funds in Minnesota. Good news has come out of that. Generally, the actuarial calculations are complete and accurate, although we did notice some exceptions. One of them was the mid-year decrement issue. That was something that we talked about a few years ago. One of the things that the independent valuation system does, the value that it brings to you, is that we were able to identify that issue where that might not have been covered if the actuary is using the same valuation system as the fund actuary. On page 11, the other aspect of the review is a non-replication review. The goal is to still determine that the fund actuary's results are complete and accurate, but we take a little bit different approach. Still starting off at the left, looking at the same data that's provided by the fund administrator to the actuary, seeing how that's handled by the fund actuary, making sure that that piece is correct. But the major difference is the two boxes in the middle. Rather than independently coding the whole system and matching all the valuation results, we are taking a sample of some individual participants and confirming the output that is shared by the fund actuary that the assumptions, methods, and plan provisions that the fund actuary says they're using, they're actually using. Over the last 5 years, we have generally done non-replication reviews when full replication has not been done. The only exception was back in 2011 when the project scope was adjusted to meet your budget needs. And then down on the bottom of that page shows a few examples of some of the findings that we had during the non-replication review. One comment that I would make at some of those findings is really looking for those kind of things is where we brought our institutional knowledge back from when we were the retained actuary about how the funds work and seeing whether or not that was coming through in the sample lives. That was one of the things where we were able to find out what those differences and be able to report them to you. Page 12 summarizes the Milliman advantages. As Bill stated, we are a national firm with a lot of public plan expertise. Not only are we the fund actuary for 9 different statewide plans, but we're also working on special projects for a number of different states. I myself have been providing back office support to the team in Philadelphia who's been working on Pennsylvania's pension funding reform. Before I left for vacation in July, I had hoped that we'd finally reached the solution. Sadly, I just learned today that we're still working on that project. So Friday when I get back to the office, I got a little more work to do on that one. Project team, Bill's already covered that we have 5 FSAs who are the core part of our project team. That brings a significant amount of experience and expertise to the team. The significant institutional knowledge helps us understanding we're able to hit the ground running. There will be no transition with us. We'll be able to pick it up right where we left off and continue to provide service. That proprietary software. Again, that provides another level of independence. And the last, to me, is really the senior consultants really do have our fingers deep in the pie. When we are doing the reviews for you, it's not just some junior team member who's done the work, and we're taking a high-level review to see whether or not the right steps have been done. We actually dig into it to make sure that the right pieces have been followed, and we're deep into the thick of it in order to understand exactly what's going on. With that, Bill and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have of us.
Senator Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You gentlemen are from the Milwaukee office, is that right?
Madam Chair, members of the commission, yes.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Lesh, Representative Lesh.
Why, I seem to recall something packed in the cobweb recesses of my jaded mind that there was a Minnesota. Did you used to have a Minnesota office, or was there never a Minnesota office?
Madam Chair, members of the commission, we do have a Minnesota office. The expertise of that office is not for large public plan entities, such as the plans the legislative commission is addressing here. So we've, you know, Milliman will put the qualified people on the assignments, and that's why it's directed to us.
Okay, and Madam Chair,
Then
I also recall something. I don't know how many years ago it was, but involving Milliman and the prepaid medical assistance audit situation with the Department of Human Services, I think it was 2011, that used Milliman, and then that contract ended for some reason that I don't know about because I don't serve on the healthcare committees. But then it was picked up, I think, by Milliman Milwaukee. And I have some concerns. I don't know why that situation was. Can you expound on that and maybe assure us that we wouldn't run into the same situation this time?
Mr. Hogan.
Madam Chair, members of the commission, I am generally unfamiliar with what happened in that situation. Typically, Milliman, as I alluded to, is a somewhat decentralized firm in the sense of decisions with respect to our clients and with respect to our service models are made locally at the office level. So with respect to retirement plan consulting, which is our expertise, we have full say on how that gets that work gets done. So it would not. It would be very unlikely and unusual for us to ask another office to do your work for us, unless we had a significant business issue, such as significant turnover of staff, or if we had, a catastrophic event happen to the office. Then the comfort that you should take is that we have other offices that can do this work, but there is no incentive for us to not want to do your work for you. That's what we do. It's our business, and it doesn't help me to send your work to another office. It would, certainly would not be something I would want to do.
Well, and I'm sure.
Representative Lesh.
And I appreciate that, and I guess my concern was apparently the local folks were the wrong people. At least at one point for the state of Minnesota, and so I want to make sure, you know, there wasn't any migration necessarily to Milwaukee. That's where the wrong people are going to be. So,
you bring up a concern that I was told that you are going to be replacing a couple of the junior consultants that were in the current contract with other staff people. Is that true? And is there any particular reason for that?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, I don't believe that's true on this for this proposal and for the services here. The staff we've shown you is the staff that worked on this the last 3 or 4 years for sure, and will continue in that capacity. Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chairman.
Mr. Herman.
One of the aspects of that, as far as the core consulting team is concerned, it's going to be the same team that has been delivering services for you. Some of the junior people that are on the proposed contract may be some resources from other offices that we would be putting on the contract as backup support in case we needed it.
Okay. My other question is, the city of Detroit has come up earlier, and there's also the New Jersey Teachers Pension Plan that your firm's been involved with. What's been your role in addressing the pension funding issues of these retirement systems?
You're close to Detroit. You want to take that one?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Herman.
As far as Detroit is concerned, that work is being led by Glenn Bowen out of our Philadelphia office. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, all of the work and consulting has been provided out of that Philadelphia office. Other than hearing about it in the news, I have no other direct information on that.
Okay.
For New Jersey, work is also done by our Philadelphia office, led by Scott Porter. And I have not been involved in any of the review work for those.
Has the Milwaukee office been involved with any pension plans that have had problems that you could address then in my question, response to my question?
So Scott Porter of Philadelphia office also leads the consulting to the state of Pennsylvania's budget office. Over the last 3 years, we have been working with the budget office in looking at different plan designs, funding mechanisms, different assumptions and methods to help with their funding problems. In that capacity, I have been serving as back office technical support in reviewing the work that's been done on behalf of Pennsylvania.
Mr. Hogan.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, we have been involved in some other controversial type situations, but not anything where Milliman was culpable for any issues, and just the opposite. We were brought in a number of years ago with the Milwaukee County retirement system issues to do an audit and to do some reviews after that situation arose. And and to my knowledge, they were very happy with the work we did and helping them sort some of their issues out. I know that Mr. Herman has personally worked with the city of Milwaukee on some asset liability studies and other issues that they were dealing with. So we're not a stranger to some of these issues. And to my knowledge, for instance, the work in the city of Detroit there's no issues with Milliman's work product per se. I think it's more the political issues are very charged there naturally, and so there are parties on both sides with that. But certainly Milliman's work product, I believe, has been received favorably by the persons paying for that. So I'm not aware of significant issues with respect to any of those situations for that Milliman has actually done anything or that's been a problem. And certainly the Milwaukee office of Milliman has not had any issues with any of their pension clients.
I think I'm not concerned about how Milliman's product. I'm more concerned with how you deal with clients where there are significant problems, how you work with them, how you offer suggestions for change. For example, with elected officials.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, yes, we're there to help guide them with the numbers. We're very careful not to overstep our bounds, in terms of trying to set public policy. But we certainly have provided tools, things like projection systems when there have been concerns about where certain tax rates might be leading or certain legislative proposals. I know that Mr. Herman has done a significant tool with the City of Wichita plans a few years back. And so we work very closely to try and engage what the issues are once the concerns are voiced and provide the information to help deal with that, certainly. We come up with ideas by talking with our strategic planning group and seeing what others have been doing too to provide data on those types of things, things that you've been addressing, for instance, such as defined contribution versus defined benefit programs, et cetera. We provide significant information in that regard when called upon.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Herman, you had indicated earlier with your familiarity with the Minnesota program, one, the desire to reduce COLAs until there was a certain achieved funding level, and the second, with the statutory policy of an anticipated rate of return. And maybe I just misread your statements, but you indicated that that was somewhat perhaps out of the norm. I can see the COLA issue, but don't we work toward some type of anticipated rate of return so we can reverse engineer back into contributions as a part of the actualization and annuitization process? That just struck me as kind of odd that was perplexing to you in your work that we would have something like that. And maybe I misread that in your statements, but I just want to give you a chance to clarify for us.
Mr. Herman.
Madam Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, thank you. So my comments there is that there's really three different aspects of the Minnesota pension plans that provide extra complications that are out of the norm for many statewide plans. The interest rate assumption in particular is typically a flat rate. Before the changes that were enacted, I believe, in 2012, the state of Minnesota had a flat 8.5% interest rate assumption. The 2012 changed that from a flat 8.5% to 8% for 5 years and then 8.5% after that. That isn't overly complicated, but it's an extra layer of complication that when you're reviewing an actual evaluation, you need to be careful to make sure that that's managed properly, reviewed properly, and done according to the statutes.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The difference between an 8.5% return, I know it's going to shock everybody in this room, is 0.5%. But when you're looking at the standard deviations, when you're looking at investment analysis on that, those have got to be in the same standard deviation. So there wouldn't be that much complexity there, would there?
Mr. Herman.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. As far as setting the assumption, it's not that complicated. But making sure that all of the different aspects working through the actual evaluation process are handled correctly, including not only determining the present value of future benefits, but the present value of future normal costs under the integration normal method, that's an extra level of complication that isn't in the same funds where there's just a flat interest rate assumption.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Members of the committee, we're losing steam here. Is there a good one?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't have any questions at this time because of the fact that they have been serving
for us.
Yes. Yeah.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we noticed this when we did the subcommittee looked at this, that most of them were using the ProVal system. You have your own proprietary system. Are there other people using your system? Do you sell that to other people, or is it only you using that? And you've touted in your testimony that you think it's an advantage to have a system different than other people because it may catch things that if everyone's on the same standard system, the same information is going to come out when you plug the same data into it. So I guess what are the benefits of having that,
Mr. Hogan,
your own system?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, yes. We think that it gives the advantage of catching some things, such as the mid-year decrement issue that Mr. Herman alluded to. These are things that that come out of their system differences. It's you can program a system one way or another, but the system itself has inherent methodologies that are built into the system itself. And so those kinds of nuances can create differences. And so we feel it's important to be able to identify those differences to make sure they're not too great. And it's just another a way of identifying how certain things might be getting treated. ProVal is a system that's widely used on the market. Milliman actually uses it in some instances as well. We have that capability. But we also maintain this system, which has a significant staff in Seattle maintaining it. We have leased it to other clients in limited situations for their use, but in general, it's not a commercially available system that other actuarial firms would use.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Finally, we're going with PricewaterCoopers, and they are doing a PowerPoint, and so it'll take us a minute to set up the PowerPoint, and then one of their consultants is joining us by conference call. So although the bathroom over here is unisex now, but if anyone wants to use it, be sure you lock the door.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Commission.
We appreciate your work for us for the last 5 years.
Thank you.
Yeah, did you have any? You haven't heard the third time, but did you want
to?
Is Melman going to come and testify?
They've given us at least one presentation per year.
Frank?
Some of the questions I'd like to bring up.
Basically, the product of their
insurance.
That's
a good idea.
Members, can you all see this?
I'm
this
on the chart.
Yeah.
I'll put my glasses, but if we have a handout here.
And you're giving me this. You're giving me your power.
So who do they deal with? We just generally consult with
them. They do largely just public.
They...
They're not exclusively public pension. I thought you meant.
That's a minute.
Oh, we did.
Deloitte's an accounting firm. That's what I thought.
I did buy that.
Quite diverse.
That's what I meant.
Two that are just wholly pensions are mainly forced to foster. It's public pension.
Then should it cost
Jim Nobles.
Does that mean
we can afford any of this?
I suppose.
It's close to what we're budgeted for, and we're also going to have some salary savings. With
I just said, hadn't called any candidates.
That will take a while to fill.
Speak well, I guess.
New personnel.
Even they have no presentation. Edge of Place was not going to come in at Ed's salary. My list would come in at my
salary. They always do Miss America, don't they?
They're quite making money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what happened with the...
Right? You don't pay attention to
Miss
Pricewaterhouse? Do they do Miss America?
The team that...
Having a six
that system is not very flexible when it comes to compensation.
The what?
The Oscars. I came in at the top of the range when I came back in 86 with much gnarling and much nasty.
One thing we don't have is kind of
presenter who was on the left. He's been involved.
Is there an advantage to
since the earliest days?
They're available. They can come over here.
Academy Awards.
A backup.
I don't believe so.
I want people to kind of think about these different evaluations.
Maybe we do. Maybe we do. But the Academy Awards is Academy Awards. Everybody knows about those.
1720
or maybe
lost out.
So
he's
got a long history.
It used to be when I was a little
Tim
Herman
has more.
Yeah,
absolutely. Indicated that
they're
placed nationally.
Certainly
seems right.
Speaking of
national
insurance,
they're
all.
Well, all these guys do. They all. I mean, I like that.
I wonder how many questions. If they.
I didn't put together that sort of a list, and I'm not sure that it would have been through my lens and not necessarily your.
And some of your questions are trying to get at some of that.
I'm sure where that's happening.
Yeah, I also noticed that so far Deloitte's the only one in their senior staff.
Which is also there on the FSA.
What's an FSA?
That's the Retained Society of Actuaries. That's the highest credential. The ASA, which the other guys are, has fewer exams. They pass fewer ways. So it's still a credential.
One at home the whole time.
They're permitted to sign on experience.
She's the only one.
The ones that they're putting on our team, yes. And she's only the reviewing. She's the peer review person. So she's not the production person.
The GovOps.
So that's another.
You're on speaker.
I'm not arguing either way.
Hi,
it's but
it's, there we go.
Great, thank you. We're hearing you quite well. We're getting ready to start.
Perfect.
Well, that's fine. I'm just ready to go work. Anything else that should bring up? I mean, I haven't been. It seems like they've all had delivered. Problems we stress, and I think that's something that we have to stress that we want them.
Pretty good.
I have the sense that money is the right word.
Chat expense form.
Someone hurt you. Yeah. Oops.
Thank you.
Great, thank you. Just probably advise me.
No.
That matters.
It could be just what they had for lunch, agreeing and disagreeing with them.
I've had their.
We had more when we had them do full evaluations than now. By advancing the business, there's a little more. There we have pension fund actuaries produce rather than having to deal with of data or whatever.
I think that they have
the normal actuary has to make sure that data is all
together. 17.
They get a copy.
Mine is 17. I bet yours is 18.
And then they react to it. So
you're just a little further than I am.
The new thing that's going to happen is with it and me the next year or two. Before our next session.
How far do you have to be before you start?
Session.
How are the lines?
You're going to depend on somebody for advice, and whatever staffing, whatever staffing you pick, may not have a change of expertise. It looks like a process. It's going to be difficult to find. So you probably depend on pension stuff. You depend upon pension stuff more with your consultant. Yeah. So you have to have a good rapport with whoever you get.
Okay.
Maybe dealing with them more.
Okay, I think we're ready to get started again. We have joining us by phone is Cindy Fratterrigo. Welcome. And I'm not sure who is presenting here today. Oh, I see some names. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourselves if you're ready to get started.
Good afternoon. I'm Karen Harris. I am the relationship manager for the state of Minnesota. I am part of the local PwC office here in Minneapolis. We have a number of projects that we have in process with the state. The largest one is with the Min.IT organization, and we are supporting a number of security projects, working with the MinSure team, and also working with a team that's doing some IT modernization work across a number of agencies, including with MinLARS. In addition to the formal work that we're doing with the state, we're also doing some, we're very much engaged with the communities across the state and also with a number of organizations. One specific example that I'll mention is that we have a very large initiative across our firm to help with financial literacy. So given that that's one of our core competencies, we work with the public schools in the city of Minneapolis to offer up some pro bono hours with our employees and do some volunteer work with the schools to help there. And one other thing that I'd mention is that what we really try to do and what my role really is all about is helping to share information across our team so that, you know, over time we can do a better and better job of serving the state of Minnesota.
Cindy?
Yes, next.
Hello, everyone. Sorry I cannot be there in person today. I'm Cindy Fratterrigo, and I will be the primary actuary for this project. In this role, I will work closely with Brandon and the rest of our actuarial team, and will oversee the team as they work through the engagement. I'm going to be responsible for providing the deliverable, making sure it's really a high-quality deliverable that's easy for you all to understand, and more importantly, is actionable. And once we give you the results, we want to make sure that they can be actioned. I'll also be meeting with you kind of throughout the whole project, presenting our results, answering any questions that you might have regarding your plans, etc. As background, I've been with PwC now my entire career, which unbelievably is now 21 years. I split my time approximately 60% working on my actuarial clients and managing their retirement programs, and about 40% of my time is assisting our audit team on our audit clients, where we review the pension and the retiree medical information that would show on their financial statements. So it's very similar to kind of the review that's being requested here on another actuary's work and making sure that, you know, the results that are presented are fair, accurate, based on good sound principles, all that good stuff. My actuarial clients, I do have clients in both the public sector, my two large public sector clients being the Indiana Public Retirement System and in the Missouri Teacher Systems, as well as in the private sector. So with that, Brandon, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, everyone. Can you hear me okay, since my microphone is behind
the... Bring the mic up a little closer.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, my name is Brandon Robertson. I'm a director at PwC in Chicago. I've been with the firm for 14 years, which is my entire career, so this is my first real job, if you will. In this role, I'll be the secondary actuary, so I'll be kind of assisting Cindy with everything that we do for Minnesota and the Legislative Commission. My experience is probably similar to Cindy's. I spend about 60% of my time working with public sector clients. So I'm a co-lead on the Indiana Public Retirement System engagement, also on the Minnesota Teachers Plans, which are kind of similar in size and complexity to the Minnesota plans. Another 20% of my time is in the private sector, working with private companies on all things actuarial pension consulting related. The last 20% of my time is probably in an audit support role. Being an accounting firm, just because Cindy and I and Sheldon are actuarial consultants and work in the HR space, we're also engaged by our audit teams to review the actuarial information and valuations and assumptions and everything that are implemented by other actuaries for the companies that we're auditing. Sheldon?
Madam Chair, Commission members. Good afternoon. I'm Sheldon Gamzon. I'm a principal in PwC in our New York office, and I'm a leader of our public sector retirement practice. I've been a retirement.
Did you say you're in the New York office?
Yes.
Okay.
I've been a retirement actuary for 38 years, so in contrast to Brandon, this is my last real job. 20 years of that time has been spent in the public sector. Most of my clients, list of my clients include the states of New Jersey, state of Pennsylvania, state of Virginia, state of Missouri, state of Indiana, state of Ohio, as well as some large municipalities, the city of New York, where I was the auditing actuary for the city of San Diego, where we were recruited by the audit committee for the city to investigate their debacle. As well as the city of Memphis. I'm also the actuary for the United States Coast Guard and the U.S. court systems. My role in this engagement will be to provide backup for Cindy and to Brandon, as well as provide any advice and support that I can offer in the process. We were sitting in the back during the other three interviews, and so we heard some of the questions We just wanted to say distinguish ourselves in some ways, our public sector practice from some of the others. Our focus by design is on large state systems or large municipalities. We're not interested in doing the work for a 5-person police department or an ambulance or something like that. Our focus is on large state systems dealing with complex issues. And that's where our business is. Cindy?
Core engagement team and also the backup manager and peer review partner. So in the middle section of the team chart, you'll see Gina Urich and Carolyn Bowden. Gina and Carolyn are going to be working with Brandon and myself on the project, kind of doing the day-to-day, all the hard work that Brandon and I take credit for. So Dina and Caroline, both similar to Brandon and me, also split their time and work on governmental clients, private company clients, and on audit support clients. Similarly, down in the bottom square, Kyle Sherlock is listed as the backup project manager, and Kyle's role mainly be to assist Dina for any reason if Dina is out and even help Caroline on it. You also see in the bottom corner Carolyn Stager. Carolyn is listed as the actual staff. We have plenty of other staff that are also going to be involved in it. Carolyn is earmarked specifically for this team, but we'll have other team members that will help on the staff level. The one thing that you'll see is both on our core team as well as on our backup with Jack and Sheldon and Kyle, we both teams have two FSAs and one ASA on them. So we do have the credentials to help support the project that you're requesting from us. You also see in the bottom left-hand corner, we've included Teresa Yanacon on the proposal. Teresa is an accountant, a CPA, who specializes in employee benefits. And Teresa routinely works with us on a number of our engagements, especially those that have some complex features to them and that might have some harder accounting questions that come along with it. Teresa will be available to the committee throughout the whole engagement. As an example of how you might utilize Teresa, for Indiana, Brandon and I teamed with Teresa on a project that they requested where they wanted to understand when GASB 67 and 68 rolled out, they wanted to understand how some of the intricate features of their plan and how they administer a plan fit in with the GASB standard. So we teamed with Teresa to come up with an implementation guide that was customized to their plan that they could then use to talk with their audit the auditors and make sure that everyone was on board in front of when we have to actually implement the new standard. And so it's, you know, hopefully that will be something that will be beneficial to the committee as you're thinking through the engagement. But overall, you know, the entire team looks forward to the opportunity to kind of partner with you on this engagement. You know, we believe that we will be able to leverage both our actuarial knowledge that we have from the governmental clients that we work on, as well as the skills and, you know, the review protocols that we establish as part of the work that we do on our audit clients for their pension plans. So with that, if you look in the middle part of your handout or placemat, we thought we'd start by sharing with you why we believe PwC is the right choice to partner with the committee. So on the top left, one of the things that you'll see is we believe we'll bring a fresh perspective. As you know, PwC has not been involved in any aspect of the actual evaluations of Minnesota's benefit programs in the past. So let's see this as an opportunity on this review engagement, as we're going to bring a fresh perspective to the engagement. You know, we're going to be completing each step of the engagement with a fresh set of eyes, with fresh programming of each of the plans. Now, we're not going to have any preconceived ways of how we think the benefit program should be valued. You know, we don't have any reason to have a bias towards any of the selected assumptions or methods that are being used. When we took a step back and read the proposal, throughout the key reason that you would have an actual review completed is really to get that independent person in there to review the assumptions, the methods, the process, look at the census data, the benefit calculations, the overall results, to really see, you know, does that independent person agree with the results? Do they think that they're based on sound actuarial principles and assumptions? And, you know, are the, in combination, are all those things going to help the plan and the committee, in this case, meet its ultimate goals? To us, having a fresh set of eyes to complete the review, hopefully that will have a potential to find areas for further discussion that the incumbent actuarial auditing firms may not as likely have seen, because they may have been relying on some procedures or some programming that was completed in the past, especially if, you know, it's one of the plans where there haven't been any recent changes in them and that pre-program, if you will, has been completed. One of the things that you heard us say a couple times here as we introduced the team is our team has a balance of working on both governmental clients as well as a number of audit engagements. And the audit engagements really are, you know, helping the audit teams review all the similar aspects of the pension obligations that are showing up on financial statements. And that's really what's being requested in this proposal. So we believe that our balance of our actuarial clients in both the public and private sector, as well as just our actuarial evaluation work that we do, will provide the committee with the required technical knowledge specific to your plans, and also the, you know, the preset, if you will, audit or review protocols and skills necessary to apply what we like to call the professional skepticism to the review process. You know, we want to be able to ask the right probing questions to really confirm that we truly understand what the results are that we're reviewing. That we really understand the methods and the processes that went behind setting the assumptions. You know, how were the experience studies done, et cetera, to make sure that all the right pieces are put together on the evaluation level, if you will.
Yes.
And then ultimately, we want to make sure that the results that you have are accurate and they're in accordance with the governmental accounting standards. And more importantly, they're in accordance with the standards for the actual work that's required by the legislative commission. We do, you know, one question that often comes up is, you know, do they have experience to work with other actual firms? Will they, you know, will they be professional in that relationship, all that good stuff? And we do want to let you know that we routinely, as part of our audit support work, we routinely work with other actuarial firms. You know, we professionally ask the questions, we're respectful of their answers, and think through the methods that they're using. We do have at PricewaterhouseCoopers, as you likely saw in our response to the RFP, we do have one actuarial evaluation system that we use. All of our staff are trained on that system. So, the reason that's beneficial to the committee is the fact that we have one valuation system that our team, you know, all the way from associates up through the partners, that everyone works on a combination of public sector clients, private sector clients, audit support clients. It allows us to have the deep bench strength. So if for any reason, you know, multiple projects come in, new projects come in, the committee has an urgent request, one of our other governmental private clients have an urgent request with the ability to kind of reshuffle staff as needed to meet each of our clients' needs. We wanted to confirm that we have been involved in similar projects at other governmental clients in the past. We went ahead and wanted to give you two examples. Sheldon actually led both of these examples. One was at Virginia and one was at Pennsylvania. For Virginia, we are hired by the Joint Legislative Audit and Review Commission to review various aspects of our pension system and discuss with them different strategies for reducing the ongoing costs, benchmarking relative to other plans, consider some different plan design analysis, etc. So it's part of this exercise to help understand their plans. Part of the exercise is also to replicate the valuation results from their actuary. For Pennsylvania, somewhat similar. PwC was hired by the state senators to similarly review their pension system, where we were asked to replicate the actuary's work. And on this one, we were asked even to discuss some of the more technical actuarial valuation process pieces. For example, one of the requests was to explain the interest normal funding method that's used and what its impact are on the results. But for these, we did have some questions. There were some follow-up items that we had to discuss in detail with the actuary and work with the client to kind of resolve some of the differences to make sure that, you know, both sides were in agreement on some of the best approaches going forward. So it was a teaming exercise where, you know, we worked with our client as well as liaised with their actuary on those engagements. Our firm, you know, you show on here independence, quality, timeliness. Hopefully, if you spoke with any of our references, hopefully they confirmed the quality of our work and the timeliness of our work. I think the other thing on the independence side, you know, our firm is built on a reputation for having high-quality deliverables and that independent, objective advice. The actuarial teams, we apply the same strict quality control procedures to our actuarial projects as to what our audit teams do and our tax colleagues do on their projects. You know, our real goal for this project is for the committee to see us an extension of your team. We're going to be that fresh set of eyes to help you understand the quality of the results that you're receiving and, you know, to provide you with says actionable results. When you get a report, we want, you know, to the extent there are any findings, we want to make sure that you're able to action those findings. And then finally, you know, we understand that what we're going to be doing on the project isn't just a review of evaluation, a review of the different cost analysis. And the committee is also looking for an advisor who can help them think through the recommendations and proposals, that, you know, look through some of the different requests that are coming in, and fully understand what those mean to the financial health of the plan, to the participants. You know, are there other innovative strategies that should be considered? And we're going to let you know that we have developed tools that we've specifically developed them for our governmental clients to help facilitate the discussions that were coming in for this exact reason. You know, when a proposal came in, what does it mean? You know, how can you work with us in real time to understand what the impact to our plans could be? So hopefully, with those pieces of background, hopefully that helps you understand TWC a little bit better and why we think that, you know, would be a great choice. And with that, I'm going to ask Brandon and Sheldon to kind of walk you through some of the different projects we do and how we bring our fresh perspective. Brandon?
Sure. Thanks, Cindy.
Thank you.
You know, inside the placemat here, we've listed a few things where, and these are really focuses of what some of the projects that we would be doing for this engagement and kind of how we think we separate ourselves. In terms of audit experience, I think you've heard Cindy and all of us kind of say that we spend a pretty significant amount of our time, each of us, doing audit support, and that means reviewing the work of other actuaries, reviewing assumptions and methods, how those methods are applied mathematically, reviewing data, doing replications of valuations for audit purposes, or in fact, whenever we take over a new client, that's the first thing we have to do as actuaries, is to replicate the prior actuary's results. So these are things we're doing kind of every day in, day out. But what is it that kind of, how do we take that to the next level, is I think where what we're trying to propose here is that, outside of just saying, you know, we've reviewed the actuary's results, we think that they've applied the mathematics properly, I think you would want us to put ourselves in your shoes and say, well, what else do I need to know? And that's kind of what we're proposing here. So from an audit perspective, it's, you know, we've reviewed that the amortization method for the unfunded liability is being applied properly, but what do other companies do, or what are other state municipalities doing? You know, how do they amortize their unfunded? Are we kind of in the norm? Are we outside the norm? But what's going to happen 20 years from now when that amortization period starts to get low? Is our cost going to be very volatile? And so maybe we should be amortizing it in layers instead of one chunk being amortized over a specific period of time. So these are the kind of things that I think you would want us to, those questions to be asked as we're going along, and that's what we're proposing to do. You know, we do this quite a bit. You know, we listed on here that our group nationally, I think, you know, we do audit support for over 1,000 clients, PwC clients. Now, that's not Cindy, myself, and Sheldon alone. That's everybody. But, you know, I've done my fair share. 20 or 30 a year is probably about average for me. You get to see a lot of strategy. You get to see a lot of different clients, what they're doing, both public and private, and that's the kind of information that, you know, allows us to ask the questions that I think you would want us to ask if we put ourselves in your shoes. In terms of experience studies, again, you know, this is the kind of work we do for large public sector clients. Indiana, Missouri, we've done these for, you know, plans with hundreds of thousands of lives. Something we review quite frequently. You know, every time we need to look at assumptions, that's our first question. When was the last experience study? What did it show? If it's not a large enough population, what other kind of data or backup is there? So we're kind of used to doing this. Again, where we think we set ourselves apart is to start asking the question, why? Or did you think of this? For example, I use a turnover assumption as an example. You know, a lot of systems use an age-based or a service-based turnover assumption where, you know, people are assumed to terminate X percent of them depending on their age or depending on their service. But what about salary? A lot of times we see a very high correlation between what people are being paid and whether or not they're going to stay in their job. It kind of makes sense. So those people that are maybe in lower paid positions tend to have more of a flight risk. So, You know, there's often other ways to look at the data other than just, we know we have this assumption. What does the last 5 years show us? Is it the same as it was before? Do we need to update it? What about looking at things in a different light? I think Sheldon had a good example, too.
I just want to chime in on what something, Madam Chair and committee members. For example, in the standards for actuarial work that we looked at as we were coming over, we noticed, for example, that the methodology that's used to evaluate the salary increase assumption is something that we would actually propose to be changed. And the reason being, let me give you an example. Let's assume an actuary assumes that inflation is 3.5%, productivity is 0.5%, and merit increases will be 1%. So in total, you'd expect the employees to get on average 5% pay increases. Let's say it turned out to be exactly 5% during the last 5 years. But the reason it was 5% was because inflation, instead of being 3.5%, was 2.5%, and the merit increases, instead of being 1%, were 2%. Did the actuary get it right, or did the actuary get it wrong twice? We would argue the actuary got it wrong twice. And so these things should actually be evaluated in components. And when you do it that way, you get very, very different results. Just as an example, when I did the audit work for the City of New York, that change in methodology alone, budget committee, the budget head was not very happy with me, but when I delivered the news, that change alone resulted in a $500 million increase in contributions during the next year, every year for the next 5 years, it's meaningful. And so, as I said, we're going to give you a fresh set of eyes. We haven't looked at this before. We're not bound to say, since we reviewed it last year and we thought it was right, we have to say it this year, we think it's right. We're going to give you the fresh set of eyes, and if we don't like the methodology, we're going to suggest a new methodology and possible different answers.
Yeah, and maybe one step further is what happened during that experience period. You know, a lot of time, if 2008 or 2009 and in that experience period, that's a great recession. Going back to my turnover example, if you had a job during that period, almost nobody turned over. That was true across all industries, public, private. If you had a job, you were going to keep it because things were kind of tough going there for a while. But now when you look at 2012 and 2013, there's a lot more voluntary turnover. The economy is rebounding. So again, it's kind of asking those questions of, you know, should every year in this study get the same weight? I mean, do we think that 2009 and 10 are representative of what's going forward? So, again, it's just kind of us putting ourselves in your shoes and saying, what questions should we be asking as we're kind of familiar with doing this stuff? But then, you know, when there are assumption changes, it's what is the cost impact, not only today but going forward? And I think that kind of leads me into my legislative cost analysis here is, again, we do quite a bit of this for, you know, state of Indiana. There's almost not a time when we don't have some sort of legislative proposal that we're looking at or at least considering or that we know is on the radar that we're going to have to quantify. And it's not just what is the $1 answer that is the change today. It's let's look at this long term. And we've developed kind of tools that allow us to do that and kind of sit in a room with you. And so that's the reason for the crooked presentation up here, but is we just wanted to demonstrate one of the tools that we've put together. Is it's a cost projection tool. It allows us to not just hand you a paper that says here's the fiscal impact on this date, but it allows us to kind of sit in a room and model things with you real time. So I don't know if you can read the font here at the back, but it's really a projection of valuation results into the future that shows cost of a plan, funded status, cash flows. It's pretty simple, but it's very powerful. It allows us to change things immediately on the fly. If we saw a proposal that increased benefits X percent, we could plug that in and see what that does over the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. Changes in assumptions, changes in actuarial methods. What if we changed our asset method or our unfunded amortization method? So again, and I'm going to show you kind of the few pages of what it looks like. It's an Excel-based tool, pretty simple, but there's an input page, and again, at the top, it shows some of the assumptions we can input, some of the methods, and allows us to model actual experience that's different than we're assuming. What if we earn 20% in our assets this year? What if we earn negative 20%? So it allows us to do all that. So just as a case study, and here's kind of the first page. It's a projection of the funded status. So you can see where we are today. We're maybe at a little over 80% going to 100, and this is just a sample plan, by the way. But what this shows is my actuarial value of assets, my smooth value, and my market value compared to my bogey, my liability. How well funded am I? And where am I going over the next several years? So this is a 20-year projection that shows this plan's going to get to about 100%. So they're amortizing their liability and getting to their goal. This is the cost. You know, what is my actuarially determined contribution versus what is my kind of policy? How much am I actually paying? So again, this is all built on kind of what we put in, and it's modeled real time. So we're showing here that for this plan, pretty high contribution rate. It's up around 30%, but it starts to come down over time as the plan gets better funded. And then, you know, we have to pay benefits and we collect contributions. What are the cash flows in and out of this plan? So unfortunately, you can't quite see the bottom here, but there's cash flows coming in terms of contributions, which are the bars, and then kind of the wave behind there are the benefit payments going out. So the biggest of the green, light green bars here is its investment returns. So without that, you can see this plan is cash flow negative, meaning that if there's a bad return year, assets are going down because you're paying out more than you would be collecting in contributions.
Mr. Robertson, I need to ask you a little faster so we still have time for questions.
Yep.
I think we're about 20 minutes in now.
It's done. So the quick case study here is, for example, if you have, let's say, a benefit increase of 3% was proposed, but it was done in a year where we had zero asset returns. Obviously, now our funded status graph looks very different. We are not even close to 100% after 20 years. Our contribution, instead of being at 30% and going down, is now rising to above 35%. So this is just the kind of thing that we could sit in a room with you when a proposal comes out and say, well, what if? What if it was a little bit different? What if there's a different way to look at this that wouldn't result in this? So these are just kind of the tools we put together. Instead of just saying the actuary's calculated this correctly, it's what else can we look at? What else should we be thinking about?
Just a side point to that, Madam Chair. For the state of Missouri, this projection tool was used to basically, I won't say dig them out of their hole, but a few years ago, they were showing a 62% funded ratio. We worked with them using this tool to completely overhaul their funding policy, completely overhaul their cost of living adjustment policy, and now, I'd say by the end of this evaluation, they're going to be well over 85% funded. Without any actuarial magic, as they say, without any shell games, it's a well-disciplined approach to funding the plan, a well-disciplined approach to providing the benefits. This tool was basically the backbone for doing all of that.
Do you want to pick up with?
Yeah, just quickly about defined benefit versus defined contribution. I don't think you can open a newspaper any week without seeing some state system, some municipality looking at the change from defined benefit to defined contribution. And it all starts from usually the employers wanting to reduce their level of risk. The defined benefit plan is too risky. We want to move towards a defined contribution plan, a more predictable type of cost. At PwC, we take a little bit more comprehensive look at just that. Because frankly, if you think employers and states can't manage the risk of the retirement program, if you shift the retirement program responsibility to employees, they are less capable of managing the risk. Every survey that's ever been done shows that employers earn about 1 to 2% per year more in the defined benefit plan than employees earn in their own 401k plans. So coming from the private sector and the public sector, we can tell you that the 401k system, the defined contribution model, hasn't worked in the private sector. It's resulted in people having to work longer than they want to. It's resulted in bottlenecks, succession planning issues. So we take a very different approach. By bringing some of the ideas from the private sector, for example, cash balance plans, market-based cash balance plans, Pension Preservation Plus, probably some things you haven't even heard about because in the public sector they don't even exist at this point. They really have not gained the popularity yet. But by us bringing those ideas to you, along with this kind of tool and the plan designer tool, which we don't have a chance to show you, that it gives you a totally fresh perspective to the decision making about defined benefit and defined contribution plans. We've used that tool in Missouri, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Indiana, and Ohio, and have gotten different answers. It's not one single answer. We don't have a position or a point of view about which is better, DB or DC. But based upon the objectives and based upon the fact pattern of the employees and how knowledgeable they are about investments, you get different conclusions. And I think that's the kind of perspective we're prepared to bring to you.
We basically have a list of questions.
I need to allow the members to ask some questions, and I'm losing people.
That's right.
So I want to make sure. I think you did an excellent presentation. I have a question first. Is you're a very large, diverse firm located in New York. We would be like a little fish for you, a small client. How do we know that we would get the kind of attention from you that we need?
That's an excellent question. In fact, I always say that to people as well. You don't want to be the biggest fish in the pond, and you don't want to be the smallest fish in the pond. You don't want to be the biggest fish in the pond because then the firm that you're working with doesn't have the capability to deal with the complex issue because they haven't seen them before. You don't want to be, by any stretch of the imagination, the smallest fish in the pond because you're not going to get the commitment from the staff. You're not going to get the resources. In our group, in our public sector group, Brandon and Cindy are our, in addition to myself, are our lead consultants. We are committed for the five-year period of time that Cindy and Brandon are going to be your lead consultants. And frankly, interestingly enough, you mentioned that Brandon and Cindy mentioned they had spent their entire career with PwC. Everybody on the team, with the exception of me, has spent their entire career with PwC. And we are committed to keeping this team intact, working with you and working with the commission and your actuaries to make sure that the work is done as we promised.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder if somebody can summarize what you know about the differences in the Minnesota system compared with the other statewide clients that you have.
Well, what we do know from Senator Goodwin and Madam Chair, what we do know from some of the information is that there's been a fair amount of controversy around your cost of living adjustments. In fact, having gone through the court system with Colorado and I can't remember who the other state was. There was a third state that then also pushed forward on making changes to the cost of living adjustments. And as a result of that, you've changed, for example, the methodologies that you use to value your cost of living adjustments. We've also taken note of, we knew this, but we weren't quite sure of exactly how it was played out. But sitting in the back, we also found out that you've moved towards reducing your interest rate assumption, which, frankly, 8.5% was kind of at the far end of where most public sector systems are. You've made the correct move in moving that down a bit. You're probably still at the extreme in terms of, because on balance you're probably using a rate closer to 8.3 or 8.4%. You haven't moved that much as compared to where everybody else is at this point. So those are some of the things that we're aware of. I don't think we have dug in too deeply into.
Yeah, well, I think those are some of the differences. Maybe some of the similarities are, you know, for Indiana, our engagement covers, you know, general employees, police and fire, judges, you know, police, conservative officer, I mean, teachers. So in that respect, I think the types of plans and the people that are covered are very similar to what we've seen elsewhere, and kind of who those stakeholders are and what their interests are. And those plans are very familiar to us. So maybe that kind of addresses the similarities.
Representative Khan.
You're one of the few people who, one of the items that you have here is the consideration of hybrid plan designs. Are you familiar with any place that is using a hybrid plan design?
Sure.
Any public place?
Yes. State of Kansas, State of Nebraska, they've both implemented cash balance plans. State of Alaska at one point had one, but I think they backed away from one. Brandon and I actually co-authored an article for NASRA introducing a new kind of hybrid system. What we call Pension Preservation Plus, which has gained some traction in the private sector, but again, has not really made it into the public sector. So, yeah, there are some systems. In fact, the term hybrid means different things to different firms. Some firms will define hybrid as meaning I have a defined benefit plan and I have next to it a defined contribution plan. Actually, quite a number of systems are moving in that direction right now. Hybrid typically means where your defined benefit plan is itself something that looks like a defined contribution plan. Not that you have a defined contribution plan sitting next to it, but the defined benefit of plan looks like one, and that would be like a cash balance plan, which, again, as I said, Kansas and Nebraska both have adopted those systems for their new employees and for their the new employees. Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions, Senator Goodwin?
One last quick question. What successes and failures have you had in dealing with some of your statewide clients who have funding problems?
Okay, well,
in 2 minutes.
Well, I think we mostly, I think we both can say Missouri has been a tremendous success. I mean, to get the funded ratio up from 62.5% to over 85% in a period of 3 years, without any sleight of hand, without magically changing assumptions, we didn't change an interest rate. Everything was done based upon the actual experience of the plan, modifying the way they provide the benefits and changing the way they charge employees and charge the school systems, the school districts, for the cost of benefits. I think that's been a tremendous success. I would say Ohio, the state teacher system of Ohio, was not as much of a success because, unfortunately, similar to what was described, I guess, in Illinois, they weren't funding the ARC for years. And that, once again, there was no enforcement for them to fund the ARC. And as a result, their contributions were capped at 24% of pay, 10% from the employee, 13% going into the pension system, and 1% going to the retiree medical system. It wasn't sufficient. So we required the state legislature to come in and mandate that they move to a 30-year amortization, which meant that, unfortunately, benefits got reduced for employees, new employees, existing employees, and even retirees. So everybody ended up, unfortunately, losing because of a lack of discipline. So I would say that would be a place where we were part. I don't think we weren't responsible for it, but we were part of the failure to get the system funded properly.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We really appreciate you coming in and giving your excellent presentation. And it's Ms. Frattarigo. Sorry you couldn't join us, but we heard you loud and clear. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for your time. Thanks for offering your opportunity.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So while they're wrapping up or leaving, I just wanted to bring up a couple issues for us to consider, and we're going to kind of rank the firms in our order of choice. Is we noticed that, just for you to think, we noticed a couple of the firms had people who had the FSA qualification, which is the highest level of qualification. What's it called? Everyone had an FSA. Okay, all the presentations had FSAs. Some had more than others. Okay, I thought just two of them had that. We had a little bit of a discussion about, do we want to be a big fish or a little fish? Will the large firm, you know, be able to meet our needs, or will a small firm be more pay more attention to us?
Who's small and who's large?
I would say that Bryce Water Coopers is large. I would say Milliman, large and diverse, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. They have more types of clients. Actually, I'd say Deloitte is large. Foster and Foster does mostly public pensions, and I think Milliman does mostly public and some private pensions.
Right.
Okay. They're all pretty large, but some are more diverse.
Foster seemed to be the smaller. Yeah.
Foster is smaller, more focused on public pensions. Is it important to us that we have a local firm like Deloitte? They can be here in a moment's notice, or does it really not matter in the age of internet and phone conversations and conference calls? And they would put in their bid, you know, how many times they would fly here. Is it good to stay with the same firm we've had, or is it good to bring in a fresh perspective? And should we be changing firms every 5 years and just to get a fresh perspective in, or somebody who really knows us, is that better? I think we already talked about diverse firms that have a variety of clients, like Milliman and Deloitte, or some that focus more heavily on public pensions like Foster. And then Mr. Martin did a cost comparison. Should cost be an issue? As we look at the cost comparison, PricewaterhouseCoopers is the highest. They're the kind of the creme de la creme. Foster & Foster is the lowest, and then Deloitte and Milliman are kind of in between with their costs. Any other things that people were aware of? Creativity. Mr. Martin said they all are involved nationally in speaking at various conferences. Foster & Foster really pushed that. Some seemed like they're, you know, Pricewater seemed like they had a lot of creative ideas, very experienced with working with a lot of large state systems. But then there was the concern about, would we get the kind of attention that we need? But they have a very large staff that with a lot of expertise. So Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had the privilege of serving on the subcommittee with Representative Nelson.
That's right. You came in late. We talked about the subcommittee in the beginning.
And Rosen, Senator Goodwin and Rosen. And one of the things that I shared with the group at that point, and I'd like to share it with the remaining members that are here from the full commission today, and that is we are going to be undergoing, and Representative Murphy hit on this earlier, we're going to be undergoing some personnel changes within the legislative commission from staffing, where the two senior people who have been here who have a vast amount of institutional knowledge on the plans and the backgrounds are going to be leaving. And that I had suggested that don't always make price or costs or what we have to pay for fees your number one or top priority when making a decision. We need to be able to have good, solid advice because you have a number of retirees, current retirees, those who would like to retire, and those who are being employed as we speak, who are relying on this plan, these various pension plans. And we need to get it right, and we need to make sure we keep it right. So what I would ask members to do is to look at what you think would be the best for us to be able to work with as a commission, not necessarily the individuals who are here now, because as legislators come and go and different kinds of things, mm-hmm. but what would be good for the long-term success of the state of Minnesota for its pension plans. And again, I'm not offering any suggestions or advice to my colleagues as to which they should guide to or away from. I just think that that's an important consideration, that we do have a lot of changes that are on the horizon. And to change actuaries, that's one thing. To get somebody who we think is going to be able to help us meet that long-term need and help transition in who the new individuals are going to be, that's also extremely important for the long-term success and stability.
Well, and Mr. Martin has said that all of these prices are within our budget. So I bring that up as, do we want that to be a consideration? Not necessarily should it be a consideration, mm-hmm. but normally it would be in normal discussion. And we did have a range.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to give the remaining members of the full commission who are hearing this the benefit of that discussion that we had at the subcommittee meeting.
Anybody else have any comments that they want to make or they want to share, concerns that they had? I don't necessarily need to think we have to have a full debate over which firm, but obviously the subcommittee felt that we had four really high-quality firms to choose from, and so there's really no bad choice here.
And Madam Chair, and Madam
makes
Chair,
it hard to decide.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, that was based on the initial proposal we were given. And
had you didn't do in-person stuff?
No, this is the in-person here. We picked the four out of the seven. These four to come do the in-person presentation. Our discussions and what we were looking at, the written proposal that were sent to us, and that's what we based our decision on out of those.
And has the in-person interviews influenced you at all, or made you feel more strongly about some over others, or any surprises?
I would say no. I would say that okay. They're all interesting proposals that they brought forward, and it's the differences of watching the way they did their presentations was interesting, but it's typical of what they do. But it's
okay. Senator Goodwin.
Well, Madam Chair, I agree that all four of these firms seem to be real high-quality firms with a lot of good points. I have, you know, there's some benefit, I think, to having people located right here in Minnesota, especially with our two experts that won't be around. But and maybe that was the question I should have focused on with all the firms that don't. Is that how do they, you know, how much will they be around for us when we need that expertise when mm-hmm. our experts are gone? But otherwise,
I think each proposal talked about, you know, twice a year or something in person as part of their bid. There's something that wasn't part of their bid, and then there would be an extra cost if they had to come in above that.
That's understandable. I'm just wondering how much extra cost we will end up acquiring when we do use their services quite a bit more when our experts leave, unless, of course, we're going to hire them as consultants to come in and tell us what to do.
Well, that's the trend now, for people to stay in the workforce longer and just reduce their hours and let them go to the cabin or take a winter vacation.
Madam Chair, our pension rules in the state of Minnesota make that somewhat prohibitive early on in separation from the state, just for the record.
Do you know somebody that could change those rules?
No.
You, Madam Chair.
No. Well, I think you
only help could be hired.
And Madam Chair, we did make some jokes about.
You have so much money or so many hours, right, that you could be hired for after you retire?
Yeah. And Madam Chair, we did make some jokes about passing legislation prohibiting them from retiring, but we were told that that's unconstitutional.
Well, we're willing to test it.
Well, we're all staying in the legislature till we're at, like, in our 70s, right?
Let's
Phyllis,
not
right,
go
Alice?
Into that.
Yeah. Look at this group. Or don't, right? Okay, anything else? Are we ready to cast our ballot? Ribson Murphy.
I was wondering if there's anybody in the audience that wants to give any advice.
I do, too.
That would be very
somebody
interesting.
Somebody might have
any advice
records with these firms that they would like to share with us, positively or negatively. Or maybe they don't want to.
I see Ms. Vanna shaking her head no.
Yeah, they're kind of backing up there.
No.
Okay.
But if the opportunity wasn't presented.
Yeah. And if you have your chance, feel free.
Madam Chair, maybe we can also ask our experts here if they have anything they want to add.
Mr. Martin and Mr. Burek want to?
I don't.
No. It's up to us. Senator Johnson?
Madam Chair, and I heard Senator Goodwin's remarks about having the importance maybe of having a physical presence here in this state. Is that a serious problem, do you think? And maybe I would ask one of our staff people.
Mr. Martin.
Senator, members, we've had this question before because we've retained an actuary by the commission since 1985. Mm-hmm. In the current scenario, and to a certain extent since the 1950s, we initially had a local actuary, and a number of different local actuaries through the period up into the early 80s. In 85, when the legislature gave the commission the responsibility to hire the actuary who did all the valuation work, we did hire a local firm, or at least a firm at a local office, the Wyatt Company. And they had the contract for 5 or 6 years. Then we hired Milliman, the Milwaukee office, and that we made the choice then that physical location in close proximity to the Twin Cities wasn't an essential item. And we've been doing it that way for some period of time. And I can't think of any particular scenario now with electronic communications and whatever being what they are, where it has made any real difference.
How much do we talk to each other in person? We all send each other emails.
Yeah.
I was emailing with Senator Marty the other day when he was in the office next to me. Representative Murphy.
One of the things following up on that that I'm still not sure of, and I started questioning it, is that how I still don't understand. I know that twice a year or four times a year or whatever they communicate, and then they give us
they come here.
They give us a report. and they have a snapshot in time that we witnessed last spring that I didn't particularly like the picture. Mm-hmm. But how, maybe we have to, after we pick somebody, then we have to sit down and talk with them about how are they going to communicate with us? Are they communicating with us, all of us, or are they just communicating with us through our directories?
Mm-hmm. Good question.
But I haven't gotten too many communications from our actuary when I was chair.
Right.
And I don't think Senator Pappas has when she's been chair. And so, and if we did, then I didn't pass it down to the members from the House. And so what kind of communication are we looking for? Or this fresh new perspective, are we ever going to are we as members of the commission ever going to hear about the fresh new perspective or the 60% of the time that they're spending for us, or 50% or 40% or whatever they quoted to us, how is that time being used? And is the time best used not communicating with us but working out the actual money and where we're going wrong and so forth, and then send us a list of recommendations?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't we looking for actually almost like a secondary actuary? Because all the pension plans have their own actuarial firms, correct? And so this is really someone to react to the other actuaries.
Members
and provide an kind of independent voice. Ms.
Members,
Martin.
If you look at this historically, the way the commission has utilized the actuary, when the commission was first formed in 1955, we hired a local actuarial firm, and it was more for the philosophical and the theoretical advice about pensions in those days. And that continued for some period of time. As time progressed, our actuary started doing reviews of the actuarial work of the various actuaries, in part because we didn't at that time specify any methods, any assumptions, and we had actuaries who were starting to play, well, that's pejorative, they were starting to utilize different methods for maybe reasons unrelated to our concerns. So the Pension Commission actuary then was the former Stennis company out of Bloomington, started doing more reviews of the actuarial work and providing the commission with a report as to each valuation and its strengths and weaknesses and any problems that the person found. When we shifted in 1985, and this is when I was still in Pennsylvania, so I wasn't here on staff, but the commission was unsatisfied with the actuarial work by various plan actuaries and decided to, we were getting multiple views of the cost of the same benefit proposal from the different pension plans, and were the rule of 85 was the question in those days. And if you're getting too many answers, one of the ways to resolve the problem is to shoot all but one answerer, and that's in essential what you did in 85, centering the actuarial evaluation work with the Pension Commission actuary. And at that point, the actuary would still provide some advice on a theoretical basis, but was mostly there to generate the reliable and accurate numbers. The way the system is set up now is you're mostly having the actuary look at the accuracy and the reliability of the results. You haven't perhaps needed as much theoretical or philosophical advice as we did back in 1955, when there was very little in-house expertise, either in the Pension Commission staff, which was essentially non-existent, or with the members. Now we've had members who've been on the commission, in some cases decades, and you have a staff that was seasoned. You haven't had the same need. You still have some in-house expertise in the membership. You're going to have less, presumably, expertise in the staff when Ed and I leave.
And I assume that none of our pension funds use any of these firms.
Right, that would be a conflict of
interest. That would be a conflict, right. Yes, so we've got a different... Okay, good.
And Madam Chair, that's...
Ripson Nelson.
5 years ago when we did this, that was... And I was on that subcommittee mm-hmm. also with Senator Rosen. One of the firms... Milliman, one of the reasons, or not, excuse me, Deloitte, one of the reasons that we did not go with them at that time, they were representing the city of Minneapolis.
Right.
And there was a conflict there, and that was, you know, again, looking at all the firms, they all had their strengths and minuses, but that was one thing that we didn't feel comfortable with. They no longer have that conflict, and which is, you know, again, it's looking at them, their strengths and weaknesses going forward.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just kind of summarize some of the thoughts that we're hearing, this may provide some clarity. We have the pension level actuarial work, and I'll call that the belt. And then what we're looking at today is the suspenders approach to that to double-check the work to see if it's plausible. What the actuary that we're talking about right now is not under – the bid and proposals do not ask them to help us to evaluate the inputs that we put into the system. It only asks them to evaluate the outcomes or the outputs of the system. If the Pension Commission feels it needs to have a separate set of consultants to help evaluate and advise on the inputs, legislation, those kinds of things, this actuary assignment that we're undertaking right now is not hitting the bullseye on that. It's being done for a different function and different purpose.
Representative Klein.
I'm not sure that people with actuarial type minds are really what you want advising on legislative proposals. Just a comment.
Okay, is there any other discussion? Then
how are you going to proceed?
I think that people should rank the firms by in order of preference, and then we should collect the rankings, unless you had another suggestion. Sam Murphy?
Number one means what?
Number one means your first choice. And number two is your second choice. Number three, number four. Representative Murphy, did you have some
thoughts? 5 years ago, you utilized this procedure when the commission seemed to be stalled and no one was willing to make a motion for any particular firm, as I recall the conversation. And someone suggested that you rank choice, and that procedure worked. That was also used by the subcommittee this time as a way to pare down the list.
I would like a short caucus with my committee members.
Okay, the committee is in recess. I'm going to go to the restroom.
Did you find an answer to your minimum fire standing? Primary funding from it is the redistribution of amortization and supplemental amortization aid.
Okay, so